Rick Smith Show starts now.
Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. Going to be talking about voting again, yes. Is it possible to be fired for voting? If you remember, you go back to the 2000 election where Republicans wanted to make it illegal to vote while black. Then this last election cycle, they didn't want students or the poor or the elderly to vote. Now a story about voting while being a Democrat. We'll talk about that. Also, sequestration all over the news. The countdown to mutual assured destruction continues. And if you remember MAD back during the 80s, both parties knew what would happen if we pulled the trigger. Well, now we're doing it to ourselves. We headed down the road to destruction, or is this another made-for-TV movie where the last second, the last tick, you know, down to the wire, we've come up with another delay. Also, it's budget time, and that means massive pain for working people and their children. I like the title, Shots for Tots and Booze for Books, Liquor for a Sticker, whatever you want to call it. We're funding our future on gimmicky schemes and on vice spending. Our budget, our governor's budget, a lot to be desired, shows the morality of our governor. Also, you know, shows ours, because we put the guy there. Also, our governor gonna be a lonely guy, I think. He's at this point one of the very few governors who has said I'm not taking Obamacare money. And I think it's gonna bite him down the road. You'll be surprised who is now taking it. Look down far south. We'll talk about that as well. Also, your calls 1-888-520-RICK 1-888-520-7425. The big sequester, more austerity. And as I look at this, as the clock ticks away, I think, what are we, 8-9 days away, the first of next month, as the time ticks away, what's it mean? I mean, if you look at, if this is allowed to happen, and I keep saying that this is another manufactured crisis, but it's a real crisis if nobody in the room says we probably shouldn't do it. If someone, you know, with their finger on the button says, you know, maybe we shouldn't push it. Maybe we should back off. They're talking about several hundred thousand jobs lost and more austerity. And, you know, you look to the rest of the world who they're trying austerity and it's not working. You look at Europe who has seen their economy, they're about to triple dip recession. So you got the president of France, Francois Hollande, who has made a trip to Athens. And in a pre-visit interview he did with the Athens newspaper, he said, quote, I reject a Europe that condemns countries to austerity without end. And you look at this and you go, what we've seen over in Europe, what we've seen across the pond is as they cut, as they gut programs, as they slash their health care, their social safety net, their public workforce, as they slash all this stuff down, they only dig themselves deeper into debt. And in fact, they were in deeper debt last year than they were the year before. And as they do more of this, it only gets worse because you're causing more stagnation. You're constricting your economy. And, you know, we talked about the study that had come out a couple of months ago where it said, well, you know, the multiplier they used was wrong. They thought by taking a dollar out of the economy, it would only cost 50 cents in reverberation. Turns out it cost a buck and a half. So for every dollar they pulled out, they, thinking it was only going to be 50 cents, actually a buck and a half. Way off. And what do you think happened? Well, it's what we've seen happen. And you've got Republicans here in the U.S. who want their own austerity. They want more massive cuts. And now I understand there's another Simpson-Bowles scheme being unfurled. And guess who's going to get screwed? You know, it's going to be you. It's going to be me. Because this one, as I understand it, and I haven't seen all the details yet, is even worse than the original gimmick. As part of the grand bargain that they couldn't reach. So this commission, they've come out with their little, and it's going to be even worse. And in fact, it's even worse than what the Republicans wanted. And you go, well, gee, you know, how did we get to where we are? And I go back to the Reagan years, where they really just laid out this plan to redistribute wealth from you and me, basically steal. I mean, I'm tired of using redistribute. They stole. They stole wages out of workers' pockets. We talked about last week the study that came out from Emanuel Saez. Well, gee, you know, the recovery that happened since the Bush collapse, 121% of the recovery went to the very wealthy. Huh. Figure that out. 121%. Well, how'd that happen, Rick? Well, it happened because wages actually fell. Not only did we not get any of the new growth out of the economy, we lost what we had. And now I look at this Congressional Research Service study, a paper written by a guy named Thomas Hungerford. He's an economist there at the Congressional Research Service, pointing out, look, you know, here's the thing, and laid this out very, very succinctly. Capital gains used to be a way that we kind of leveled playing field. Said, you know what? Income is income. And this was part of the Tax Reform Bill of 86, which I despise. But what they did is they said, okay, we're going to start taxing capital gains like income, as it should have been all along, until 1996, where we said, well, you know, we're going to reduce that because we started buying the Kool-Aid. Oh, you know, it's going to create jobs. We give the job creators more money. And it hasn't. So what Hungerford points out in his piece is, he says, by far, the largest contributor to the increase in inequality in this country was changes in income from capital gains and dividends. So as we moved that capital gains rate down, all the way down to 15%, while, you know, if you were working and you were swinging a hammer or you were climbing a tree or doing whatever, to driving a truck or whatever, brain surgery or whatever it is you were doing, you were paying 35%. Placing a bet on Wall Street was 15. And he points out the large increase in contribution of capital gains and dividends to the Gini coefficient, he says, however, is due to the large increase in the share of after-tax income from capital gains and dividends. And if you remember, he had a study not too long ago pointing out kind of the same thing. Found that from 96 to 2006, this period that he's talking about, after we said, you know what, capital gains are important. We need to have the job creators with more money. He pointed out from 96 to 2006, the income for all Americans grew by 25%. But for the top 1%, it grew 74%. And for that top 0.1%, it grew 96%. And the biggest driver, he says, capital gains. Because that top 1%, that top 0.1%, how do they make their money? Not by swinging a hammer or driving a truck or even doing brain surgery. They make it by gambling. And you go, but Rick, that's investing and that's creating jobs. Well, you know, on a level it is, but not to the level that we're led to believe. And you look at this Gini coefficient, which again looks at inequality. And for those countries that are, and it's a simple It's a simple equation. The closer to zero you are, the more zero is perfectly equal. That's what the Republicans and my rich uncle, who is in that top 1%, love to say, you know what, you Marxists, you socialists, you people want us all to be completely equal. Well, if he was correct, we would be at that zero. We would be perfectly equal. One is completely unequal, where the 1% has everything and the rest of us have absolutely nothing. So you've got the absolute extremes, the polar opposites, zero being completely equal, one being completely unequal. We fell right about 45.45, almost in the middle. While countries like Canada, 32.6, countries like Germany, 28.3, countries like Norway, 25.8, more equal. Now, I mean, we're not Zimbabwe or Swaziland or Zambia, but we're not that far behind. And I look at this and I go, you know, at some point, who's going to bail the working people out? You know, the president talked about minimum wage in his State of the Union address. And my uncle, who's a very wealthy guy, says, well, I don't know anybody who works for minimum wage, and probably doesn't. And his gated community there in the Hanna Estate, a very, very wealthy guy, and good for him. He actually hit a home run. He went from rags to relative wealth. And good for him. We want that. But not at the expense of everybody else. And he says, well, he doesn't know anybody who makes minimum wage. Well, I do. And those people are struggling right now. And we never seem to have a problem, or the wealth of this country never seems to have a problem to use our tax dollars to bail them out. And we bailed out Wall Street, and they are fat and happy. We've bailed out the entire banking industry, and they're back to fat and happy. In fact, they're bigger than ever. Now, look at this story I saw from Atlantic City, which just blows my mind. And we've been talking about Revel Casino for a while, because if you remember, they were the company who said, well, you know, we're not going to really have employees. They'll be contractors, and, you know, we can fire them after. You know, if you get fat, we can fire you because you're only going to get a year or two contract. And there were a whole bunch of really bizarre labor things that they wanted to do there in Atlantic City to pull everybody down. Well, you can say what you want. You can say it was the hurricane. You could say it was the economy that's in the tank. Or you could just say, you know what? Other states are now gambling. So building another huge casino in Atlantic City may not have been a great idea. What caught my eye, though, because I don't care if billionaires want to build casinos and lose their behinds, I'm okay with that. In fact, Morgan Stanley, who pulled out of the project, lost $1.2 billion. I'm okay with that. That's private money. You did what you wanted to do. You rolled the dice, and guess what? You lost. I shouldn't have to pay for it. But guess what? The people of New Jersey, they do. Because the Revel Casino was only completed because it got state tax incentives, which were approved last February, or February 2011. And you go, what about the free market? And you look at Christie's approval ratings. There's never been a higher approval rating for a governor with the Quinnipiac poll. Never higher. And yet he spews all of this stuff that is just not. And what's infuriating is they have been able, through heavy funding and heavy lobbying, to convince us that, you know, they're bad ideas. They're bad ideas are what we need to move forward. And that they, the very wealthy, the job creators, that they should have dictatorial power. Something wrong with that. I'm going to take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
The U.S. Supreme Court may decide if workers should be compensated for the time it takes to change clothes. On Tuesday, the highest court in the land agreed to hear a case brought by 800 workers against a U.S. steel plant in Gary, Indiana, where the court will determine the meaning of changing clothes. Attorneys for U.S. Steel argue that clothes changing, even if required to perform certain duties, isn't covered under the Fair Labor Standards Act. This isn't the first time a court has heard such a case, with judges coming down on all sides of the issue. Often, it comes down to what constitutes clothing. Due to the myriad of rulings, it's up to the Supreme Court to determine what items of safety wear are considered clothing and whether or not compensation is legally required. Even with the economy slowly turning around, college students are one of the demographics having the hardest time finding new jobs. Leilani Albano reports.
Coming out of college, Erin Foote could not find stable work and had little money, so she lived in her car.
Luckily, I have seats that lay down, so I could make one into kind of like a bed. And then in the back, I have a pretty big back space, so I kept my clothes and belongings there.
Today, more than ever, college graduates are finding themselves in dire economic straits. About 48%, or 1.5 million college grads under 25 years old, are underemployed or unemployed, according to a new study by the Center for College Affordability.
It was just sad because I felt like I went and I put all this work into a great degree. I worked so hard, and yet I couldn't find a job.
The lack of educational return can partly account for their precarious situation. While a third of all adults in the U.S. have bachelor's degrees, a center study reports that college graduates are taking jobs that only require a high school diploma. This has left more college grads finding work in the low-paid service and food preparation sectors. The trend began as collapsing financial markets stopped investing in job creation. Robert Hilton Smith is policy analyst for Demos, a research center that studies economic and democracy issues.
Basically, instead of corporations reinvesting profits in jobs and in hiring and in communities, we've really seen them instead hoard this, just basically hoard this money or put it back into the financial markets instead. And a lot of this is because we don't have unions aren't there to kind of counterbalance the power of corporate boards or corporate management in general.
This report was made possible in part by a grant from the Burger Marx Foundation.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Rebuilding America. The Rick Smith Show.
Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. So up until the election last year, we saw a lot of these CEOs sending out letters to their employees saying, you know, if you pick the wrong guy, you could be fired. You could lose your job. And we saw a number of them, who said, well, because he's going to do things, and those things are going to cost you your job. And nice threats. I mean, and not even veiled threats. I mean, outright threats. Well, now there's a woman in Ohio who is claiming that she was one of those people. She had the Obama sticker on her car. She voted for Obama. The boss knew it, and guess what? She got canned. She has filed suit in the Montgomery County Court of Common Pleas there in the Dayton area, demanding damages somewhere in the neighborhood of $25,000 against this Q-Mark Incorporated and the president that runs it. They're a big sales firm representing manufacturers and defense contractors. The company's saying, no, it's just because, Obama's bad policies, economic slowdown. And the question is, do you have a right to a job then? I mean, can they fire you for voting? Or can they vote you, fire you for voting for a Democrat? Here to help us answer that is our good friend, Attorney Erwin Aronson. Erwin, thanks for taking time for me.
Good to be here, Rick. How are you?
I am good. So, I'm sure you saw the same thing I saw up until the election. CEOs sending out letters to all their employees. The Koch brothers did it. The guy who owns the big timeshare down in Florida did it. I'm saying, look, you vote for that black guy in the White House, you might find yourself out on the curb. Is that legal?
Well, depends on where you are. First and foremost, it's definitely not legal for that to happen to anybody who's protected by a collective bargaining agreement, who's represented by a union, because in every single collective bargaining agreement that I've ever seen in my career, there is a provision that requires discipline up to and including discharge be based on just and sufficient cause, that it not be arbitrary. But for people who don't have the benefit of a union, who aren't protected by a collective bargaining agreement, who don't have the right to grievance and arbitration procedure, it really boils down to what state law is and to some degree federal law. Contrary to what we all learned in ninth grade civics class, discrimination in employment is generally very legal. There are only four areas that are illegal all over the United States as a matter of federal law. It's illegal to discriminate against employees on the basis of their race, on the basis of their gender, on the basis of their age if they're over 40 years of age, or on the basis of a disability as long as the employer has been asked and can make a reasonable accommodation to the disability. In general, beyond that, discrimination in employment is perfectly legal in the United States, and you can terminate an employee who is not otherwise protected by an employment contract or collective bargaining agreement for just cause or unjust cause or no cause at all. You can have a policy that says, we don't want people who have blonde hair working here, or we don't want to have anybody who works here who drives a Chevy, and that's perfectly legal. So in general, saying in most states that we're terminating you because you voted for Barack Obama, the President of the United States of America, duly elected by the elector selected in an election in conformity to the Constitution of the United States of America, that's not per se illegal in most states. Now, in Pennsylvania, we are what we call an employment at will state, where people who don't have the contract, like I was talking about, are employees at will, and they can be disciplined to discharge by their employer. And they're employed at the will of the employer. There is in Pennsylvania, going back now probably 23, 25 years, based on a case called Geary versus U.S. Steel, now USX, what's known as the public policy exception to the at-will employment doctrine. And that's unique to Pennsylvania. Some other states have a similar exception to the employment at will doctrine where they are employment at will state. And that says that, in effect, that an employer may not terminate a worker for exercising her legal rights, like the right to vote or the right to free speech. But remember, the right to free speech is between you and your government, not between you and your employer, right, or you and another private party. So Pennsylvania recognizes a limited public policy exception, and so if an employer were to terminate one's employment because you asked for time off to vote, when your work hours consumed the entire period of voting, or if your employer terminated you because you had indeed exercised your right to vote in a way that differed from what your employer's preference was, that's a violation of the public policy exception to the at-will employment doctrine. You'd probably be protected, but because you're an at-will employee in general in Pennsylvania, unless you have an agreement that says you have a right to be employed for a specific term or period of time at a specific rate of pay, even if you fall within that exception to the at-will doctrine, you don't really have any damages because you cannot demonstrate that you were going to go to work tomorrow because your employer always had the right to terminate you at will.
Yeah, or they just found a different reason, made up a different reason.
Well, that's the point, is, you know, they just make up another reason. And so you may have a right to your job back, but you won't have any damages because they can terminate you tomorrow because you wore khaki pants and they have a new policy that they adopted yesterday against khaki pants or, you know, whatever. or they just had a policy that they didn't want you to work there anymore without saying why.
And they don't need a reason. And I look at this story from Flint, Michigan. I don't know if you saw this, but an African-American nurse is suing the Hurley Medical Center there in Flint because evidently they decided, you know, one of the father of a newborn said, we don't want no African-American nurses. He didn't use that word. No African-American nurses to take care of the baby. And the hospital actually said, okay, we're okay with that for a while.
Well, now that falls within the ambit of the anti-discrimination statutory framework that I mentioned before. That's Title VII in the Civil Rights Act. Discrimination in employment on the basis of race is illegal. And the question gets to be, what does a vendor do, in this case a hospital, when it is confronted with a customer who's a racist? Do they accede to the customer's demand or they accede to the law? And in this country, we're a country of laws and that are ruled by laws, not by people. So the answer to that question should be very easy. And when this hospital exercised its judgment in so vile and foul and open and notorious a fashion, merely to accede to an unreasonable and irrational consumer request, they broke the law, in my judgment. And that woman has some very significant rights.
Now, what the hospital is saying is they later removed the note, but still the claim is that there were no African-American nurses who went near the child. So, you know.
Well, later removing the note doesn't change it because that created, in an immediate sense, as soon as that note was permitted to be there, not immediately removed, a hostile work environment for somebody of color. And that hostile work environment is per se a violation of Civil Rights Act, and it is per se discriminatory in employment in a fashion that violates federal law, and that person has real and meaningful rights. And there you're talking about prospective damages, not like the person who got terminated for exercising her right to vote for President Obama.
Yeah, but at the end of all this, and it comes to me, it comes back to a very simple thing. These are folks who have no voice on the job other than finding a lawyer who's willing to take it. And the story that I read, the woman who took the case is normally not, she wouldn't take it other than that, as you pointed out, it was so vile. Normally she's an attorney for the corporate side. This time, this is so vile that even she said something had to be done.
In the end, when you speak to people who have the experience that I have had in my professional life, in my adult working life, the answer, while glib, is really very simple. This is precisely why people need unions. This is precisely why the right to have a union that gives one a voice on the job, at the workplace, on the shop floor, in the office, in the cab of a truck or in the cab of a locomotive or in the cockpit of a plane, is essential, because that is the only way, ultimately, that any worker is protected on the job. We live in a country that elevates property rights over all else, but we are not given property rights in our jobs. And because we have no property right in a job, a piece of chattel property, a donkey, has more rights than a worker, unless there's a contract that says otherwise. And that union contract, that collective bargaining agreement, that grievance procedure that ends in final and binding arbitration, that contractual protection against arbitrary and capricious, irrational favoritism by employers against workers, it's always protected by a contract. And there is no substitute for that, and there never will be a substitute for that as long as we are a country that is bound up and grounded in property rights. And sadly, and it has been sad for me for what is getting to be a long career now, no one in this country and no one in the state of Pennsylvania has a property right in her job or his job, no matter what it is. And that goes from the sanitation worker to the bus driver to the school teacher to the CEO and to all of their lawyers, by the way, as well. The only right one gets in a job is a right that comes from a contract. And CEOs typically have employment agreements that protect them for a period of time. But for the rest of us, a union contract has no equal. A union contract is the one bar against arbitrary and capricious and discriminatory treatment. And it's the only true bar.
So I was going to ask you, I'm sure there's got to be a CEO out there who doesn't have one, but I would assume that the vast majority of CEOs, they most certainly have a contract with a very nice golden parachute at the end. And you look at someone like Robert Nardelli, who the former CEO of Home Depot, who, as they were showing him the door, also handed him a check for $210 million.
Well, of course. I mean, that's standard operating procedure. These people take care of one another. Most CEOs get to be CEOs by buddying up with the other people on the board of directors of their company, and CEO in company X is usually on the board of directors of company Y and is an advisor to company Z, and they all take care of one another, always at the expense of the shareholders, and more often than not, the shareholders really are employee benefit plans, pension plans that are to be protecting the workers and providing for the retirement of workers. So it's not a big deal to these CEO types and corporate boards to screw the workers. You know, that's what they do for a living. You know, there's the golden parachute. Even when there's not a golden parachute, where somebody has a contract. I mean, yesterday I heard reports on the late evening news that Jerry Cohn, who had been the superintendent of the Harrisburg City School District that was forced out prematurely before the expiration of his contract, settled his case, and that there was a seven-figure sum associated with his damages based on what he would have earned had his contract not been prematurely terminated. And the details of the settlement have not been released yet, but it was in news reports that it was going to be a seven-figure sum. Unfortunately for that poor woman in Ohio or the nurse in Michigan, there will not be a seven-figure sum at the end of this thing, and I was going to say at the end of the rainbow, but it's certainly not a rainbow. It's not pleasant. It is not only economically debilitating, but it is, as I can tell you from having represented more than one person over the course of my career in these situations, it is an emotional roller coaster, the likes of which is not known. Because imagine, if you will, being in a spot where you stood in line to vote because somebody in Ohio was already trying to make it all but impossible for you to exercise your franchise, and they had already manipulated the voting systems with, in Ohio, dramatic, if you will, diminution of early voting rights that would otherwise take place without adding any new voting machines or new polling places. And some crazy voter ID kinds of things and all kinds of problems with the polls. I mean, I was, as you know, Rick, our listeners may or may not know, I was coordinating voter protection efforts throughout the Northeast, Mid-Atlantic, and Midwest of the United States of lawyers who were working. And so I had pretty substantial Election Day interaction in Ohio, throughout Ohio, and including in the Dayton area. And I'm sadly all too familiar with the problems that were going on. But imagine, if you will, spending time standing in line, exercising that most precious of all of our rights in this country, the vote, the right to vote, the franchise, something we've talked about many times before in different contexts when I've had the privilege of being a guest on your show. And then the reward for exercising one's franchise is that the employer, who believes that he has her under his thumb anyway, because, of course, he's the boss, the boss says, guess what? I don't like your politics. Your family is no longer going to eat. Your health care is now terminated because your health care comes to you as a function of your employment. Your pension is not yet vested, and it's not going to ever be vested. All because I, as the boss, didn't like how you sounded like you were going to vote in the election. I don't know exactly how you voted because we have secret ballots around these parts, but I'm just going to assume for the purpose of your job that you voted in a way I don't like. So see ya. Get out of here. Sayonara. And, oh, if you sue me, I'm going to say, gee, and aw, shucks. It really wasn't what I said. What it was we're a defense contractor, and the defense budget might be cut sometime in the future. Therefore, I'm going to fire you now, since I anticipate that at some point in the future, I won't have work for you.
Again, come up with a nice reason other than the one that it was actually. But, you know, I bring this back, and the whole reason that I think this is important for people to hear is because, you know, that could be any one of us at any time, you know, given the winds of change. It could be anybody.
Well, it is anybody. I mean, I was talking to an old friend just yesterday. I mean, literally just yesterday. A woman who is employed in the eastern part of the state by a supermarket chain. It's a well-known one called Wide Markets, okay? And I'm permitted to say the name of the supermarket chain. And so happens I've known this woman for many, many years. Her husband was a good and dear friend of mine. He was a representative of one of the unions I'm honored to represent. And he unfortunately died, as a young man died, and his wife has to work in order to keep a roof overhead and body and soul together. And so she's working at a Wise Market. And the Wise Market that she worked at got a new manager. And the new manager, I assume, must have somebody else in mind for this poor woman's job. So she's just giving her indigestion every day, writing her up every day. She's worked at this market for years and has risen through the ranks from doing stock work to doing cashier's work to being a mid-level supervisor now, and, you know, dealing with customer service issues and dealing with pricing products and things of that nature. But the store got a new manager, and the new manager decided that she's in charge, and she's making my friend's life hell. And she can because there's not a union there. Just that simple.
And, you know, I know so many people like that. And at the end of the day, you know, the question then becomes, how do we make sure that people get those protections, given the broken nature of our labor laws and how difficult it appears for folks to be able to join and form unions with all of the attacks that are coming and all of the assaults across the country?
Well, it is indeed, on the best day, a real challenge. But we got to persevere, and people need to know that they also are protected from that employment at will doctrine when they are organizing and forming a union. And one of the statutory prohibitions on employers otherwise exercising their alleged rights under the employment at will doctrine is that they can never fire or discipline or in any way take action against a worker for that worker's exercising his or her right to organize and join a union or to refrain from joining the union. And that's a very important protection that employers don't want workers to know. Listen, I have said for many years on many occasions in many forums that I learned from one of my mentors, a guy named Milton Schaap, who was the governor of Pennsylvania when I first came to Harrisburg back in the early 1970s. Governor Schaap used to be fond of saying, you need to remember always that boss, spelled backwards, is double S-O-B. And there you have it. So people need to be mindful of the fact that they have rights, and among those rights is the right to organize, form, and join a union for the purpose of having the protection of a grievance and arbitration procedure, for the purpose of being protected from the arbitrary or capricious or whimsical treatment that they might get from an employer, for the purpose of not having to be a member of the Red Apple Club at work, but to simply go in and do your job, give eight for eight, get paid what you're entitled to get paid, what you agree to work for, and not be harassed on the job. And the only real protection for working folks to have that is to have a union contract. And there is no substitute for it, and as many impediments as are erected today to the right of people to organize unions, that's what we have to do. And all of us who are on this side of that equation need to redouble and triple our efforts to make sure that it's clear. Understand something. I've read more than once and more than a dozen times and more than 100 times the National Labor Relations Act, along with the 1947 and the 1959 amendments to the National Labor Relations Act and the 1974 amendments to the National Labor Relations Act. And shockingly, and people who hear me say this really have to catch their breath because they don't believe it. If you read the National Labor Relations Act, there's not a section, not a paragraph, not a sentence, not a phrase, not a word, not a letter in that law that confers any rights on employers. It's all about the rights of workers. Rights of workers with respect to freely choosing whether or not they want to have a union. But somehow cut out of whole cloth, for a time the National Labor Relations Board and beyond the National Labor Relations Board, activist jurists, courts, and the federal system have created out of whole cloth rights for employers under that law that don't exist in the statute itself. And I know that when I say that, people rear back. They're shocked. How could that be? Well, it's because it's the National Labor Relations Act. It's not the employer, the national employer putting workers under their thumb law. And everybody in 1935 recognized that we needed a law to restrain employers, not to restrain workers. And that's why the law is what it is and has always been what it is. Interestingly enough, the Ontario, Canada labor relations statute, their provincial labor relations statute, is virtually verbatim the same as the National Labor Relations Act here in the United States. Same English language, virtually the same identical words, but interpreted rather differently because in that country they recognize those words to mean what the National Labor Relations Act says. That is, a law to protect the right of workers to organize, form, and join unions as they voluntarily see fit on their own without the interference of employers.
I assume much the same way that that corporations became people, corporations got rights under the National Labor Relations Act.
Well, in exactly the same way, by the edict of a court, and the court was of the exact same one, the Supreme Court of the United States of America, SCOTUS, created those rights out of whole cloth. This notion of things like captive audience meetings or employers being allowed to hire consultants to talk to the workers, employers having a statutory right to replace strikers. Same law as in Canada, but there's no statutory right to replace strikers in Ontario. Same exact language.
Now, I love the. We need government out of our lives, and we need the free market. Yet, wouldn't the free market dictate that workers and their employer could negotiate without any interference?
Yeah, well, there you go.
And you look at here in the legislature, we've got Republicans who have put forth bills that would take and infringe on that right even further.
Well, you know, it's a double standard. I wish I could say it otherwise, and I wish that it really was different. But when it comes to interfering with the relationship between workers and their employers, there's just no end. I mean, we've talked in another context about these so-called no rights at work laws, right to work laws, right to work for less laws, like the one they just recently passed in Michigan. What that is, stripped of all the baloney, is a law that says the government is stepping in and prohibiting private parties from entering into an agreement that they want to enter into, employers and workers alike. They pass a law that says that they have a right under this circumstance to impair a contract, even though the Constitution of the United States says that no state may pass a law that impairs the right of contract.
So what do we do? What do we do from this point? I mean, short of the Wisconsin style taking over the Capitol and people marching in the streets, what do we do?
Well, maybe it takes marching in the streets. Maybe that's – I don't know necessarily that I any longer subscribe to the idea that we have to be short of that. I think maybe that's what we need to do. In the 1930s and the 1940s, when employers and their advocates had tilted the balance too far in one direction, when the pendulum had swung too far in one direction, workers in the rubber industry, workers in the electronics industry, workers in the auto industry, workers in the steel industry sat down. They didn't just stop working. They had sit-down strikes, and they occupied the plants. They occupied their places of employment until they got a fair and decent wage and a fair and decent contract that allowed people to have dignity in their work. We did it in the mines. We did it in the mills. We did it in the factories. And today, while we don't have so many mines and so many mills and so many factories, we have banks and we have grocery stores. And we have high-tech industries, and we have a number of things, and it may be time that we have to push back, that people need to know they have a right to exercise their rights.
But we've been told, Irwin, things aren't as bad. You needed those back then because things were worse back then.
Well, you know, people long for the good old days in many ways. And if I've heard it once, I've heard it a thousand times about how things were bad then, and unions have now exceeded their value. Unions are no longer relevant. But then I hear about this nice woman in Ohio and this nice woman in Michigan and my friend that I spoke about in eastern Pennsylvania working for a very popular grocery chain, and I know that the more things allegedly change, the more they stay the same. And I know, ultimately, that for working people, there is a simple and elegant rule, a rule I learned from my dad many years ago. One gets what one takes and one keeps what one holds, and the way one gets what one needs at work is with a union.
Yep.
Period.
Period. Exclamation point.
So, you know, sometimes we need to do things that are not exactly according to the Marcus of Queensberry rules, because sometimes we face the Koch brothers and the John Boehners and the Eric Cantors, and we have the best government somebody else's money can buy, and that government is working against us. And when the government is working against us and the bosses are working against us and the system is working against us, we need to fight back. We need to push back. And I'm not talking about anybody getting hurt. I'm not talking about fighting back in a violent sense. I'm talking about fighting back and exercising our rights. We're ultimately the greatest of capitalists. We sell our labor. And if you as an employer don't want to pay the right price for the labor, we have a right to withhold it.
Yep.
And if withholding it means that we maybe need to occupy our spot for a while, so be it. And I'm not advocating anything radical. That's exactly what every business does every day.
Yep.
They set the price of what they want to sell in the marketplace. And if you don't want to pay the price, you don't get to buy it.
It's an excellent point. And again, you know, if I go, as you pointed out, you know, those three stories, exactly the reason why I think we need more collective action. We need more people joining and forming. Irwin, it's always great talking with you. I appreciate the time.
Pleasure's all mine. Talk to you next week, and have a great week and a great weekend, and thanks to you and all our listeners. I'm looking forward to being back. We got budget stuff to talk about and possible changes to the Pennsylvania Workers' Compensation Law and still another round of assaults on unemployment compensation. And, of course, there is this little issue of funding education and funding benefits for senior citizens and the assault on the Pennsylvania wine and spirits shops and industry. So there's a whole lot going on.
I look forward to it. Irwin, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you. Take care.
Quick break, right back. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Your thoughts back after this. Beat up cars with the tires and drummers go.
In an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
Ask me, Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? Ask me, Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, Ask Me Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Besides being founders of our republic, what did Thomas Jefferson and George Washington have in common? Answer, hemp. America's founders were strong promoters of this extraordinarily useful agricultural crop, and both Jefferson and Washington grew it. The first draft of our Constitution was written on hemp paper. And as late as World War II, the government urgently pushed farmers to grow the crop as part of a Hemp for Victory program. So why are American farmers today prohibited from producing this patriotic, profitable, and pesticide-free plant? Political nuttiness. Most recently, in a frenzy of reefer madness, U.S. drug police decided that President Nixon's Controlled Substance Act of 1970 not only outlawed marijuana, but also its non-narcotic cousin, industrial hemp. If ignorance is bliss, they must have been ecstatic, yet their nuttiness remains the law of our land. The good news is that a wave of sanity is now wafting across America. In Colorado, for example, farmer Michael Bowman and Denver hemp advocate Linda Parker helped pass Amendment 64 in last fall's election. It legalizes personal pot use, which got all the media attention. But it also directs the legislature to set up a program for, quote, the cultivation, processing, and sale of industrial hemp. Bowman now hopes to be the first American farmer in generations to plant a legal crop of it, hoping to do so on April 30th, the 80th birthday of family farmer hero and hemp champion Willie Nelson. The red state of Kentucky is also on the move. Its Republican Ag Commissioner, backed by its Chamber of Commerce, is campaigning to legalize hemp farming there. And Kentucky Senator Rand Paul is co-sponsoring a national bill with Oregon Democrat Ron Wyden to take hemp off the controlled substance list. This is Jim Hightower saying, to help spread this seed, go to VoteHemp.com.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
I know many of you are going to be interested in this next subject. Pennsylvania sits within a day's drive of 60% of the nation's population. Every year, nearly $500 billion worth of goods and services move through our state transportation system. Transportation is the bloodstream of our economy. If it fails, our economy fails. However, as you know, the average bridge in our state is 51 years old.
The walls come tumbling down. The walls come tumbling, tumbling. The walls come tumbling, tumbling down.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com, or give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. You know, in talking with her, when you know, it brought back this memory of a guy that I met years ago who, you know, I was doing a little bit of organizing work, you know, volunteer thing when I was living in Cleveland, and it was a machine shop where, you know, a guy told me, I don't need a stinking union. I'll make my own deal. Because he'd been there like 16, 17 years. And he really thought he didn't need a contract, because thought the boss's word was good enough until he got hurt. And pretty substantially cut himself. A shard of metal flew off and really cut his hand up really bad, as I remember. And he was off for several months. And he went back to work, and, he struggled a little bit. And he was having a hard time, and then, a weird thing happened, and he got hurt, hurt his back. I think it was his back. And as soon as he came back to work, they fired him. Damaged goods is what the boss told him. But when they officially filled out the paperwork, it was, we didn't have enough work. And, of course, they don't go by seniority, so it didn't matter. So here's this guy, 16, 17 years on the job, loyal, dedicated employee, worked every minute of overtime. One of the key people in making it so that there was no union there. There he was standing on the outside looking at. And you talk to him a little bit later and he goes, I made a big mistake. Because that would have helped save my family. And finding another job was quite difficult for him. Because here you go, you've got this thing hanging over you. And, I go back and I think about this, because I've heard so many people tell me over the years, I can make my own deals. And you look at the last 30 years of this push towards hyper-individualism, this push towards I can make my own deals. What's it gotten us? I mean, you look at the last 3 years. That study from Emmanuel Saez, to me, is huge. The recovery that happened, that you and me and the rest of the working people of this country didn't share in, but happened anyway, went to a handful of people. 121% of all the new income gains went to the top 1%. And you go, how is that possible? It's possible because every time I turn around, I see another company asking for massive concessions or imposing them. Because the only reason you hear of them asking for concessions is because, they've got to negotiate with the unions, which companies don't want to do anymore. They don't want to negotiate with their workers. They want to impose. And I look at this story in Wisconsin, because how the Republicans love to say, we just want to, it's just public sector unions. We don't like private sector unions. Okay, let them, free market, let the free market decide. Well, Wisconsin hurrying a number of bills through the legislature there under the guise of, we're going to prevent layoffs by allowing employers to impose to union facilities, impose cutting hours without negotiating. Because, they don't want to negotiate. They don't want to give those people any dignity or respect, and think that they got to talk to them at all. That's what this is about. Pure and simple. Gonna take a quick break. Back with hour two of the program. Stick around. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Their greed and corruption are very well known. On a consumer code of silence is what they defend. We know it, so let's don't pretend. You and me know it, so let's don't pretend.
Thought-provoking, intelligent conversation with a heart. The voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
The U.S. Supreme Court may decide if workers should be compensated for the time it takes to change clothes. On Tuesday, the highest court in the land agreed to hear a case brought by 800 workers against a U.S. steel plant in Gary, Indiana, where the court will determine the meaning of changing clothes. Attorneys for U.S. Steel argue that clothes changing, even if required to perform certain duties, isn't covered under the Fair Labor Standards Act. This isn't the first time a court has heard such a case, with judges coming down on all sides of the issue. Often, it comes down to what constitutes clothing. Due to the myriad of rulings, it's up to the Supreme Court to determine what items of safety wear are considered clothing and whether or not compensation is legally required. Even with the economy slowly turning around, college students are one of the demographics having the hardest time finding new jobs. Leilani Albano reports.
Coming out of college, Erin Foote could not find stable work and had little money, so she lived in her car.
Luckily, I have seats that lay down, so I could make one into kind of like a bed. And then in the back, I have a pretty big back space, so I kept my clothes and belongings there.
Today, more than ever, college graduates are finding themselves in dire economic straits. About 48%, or 1.5 million college grads under 25 years old, are underemployed or unemployed, according to a new study by the Center for College Affordability.
It was just sad because I felt like I went and I put all this work into a great degree. I worked so hard, and yet I couldn't find a job.
The lack of educational return can partly account for their precarious situation. While a third of all adults in the U.S. have bachelor's degrees, a center study reports that college graduates are taking jobs that only require a high school diploma. This has left more college grads finding work in the low-paid service and food preparation sectors. The trend began as collapsing financial markets stopped investing in job creation. Robert Hilton Smith is policy analyst for Demos, a research center that studies economic and democracy issues.
Basically, instead of corporations reinvesting profits in jobs and in hiring and in communities, we've really seen them instead hoard this, just basically hoard this money or put it back into the financial markets instead. And a lot of this is because we don't have unions aren't there to kind of counterbalance the power of corporate boards or corporate management in general.
This report was made possible in part by a grant from the Burger Marx Foundation.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Right now, we are hard at work to bring a major natural gas processing plant to southwestern Pennsylvania. The best argument we can make to the company behind the project is Pennsylvania's embrace of free markets.
You know, maybe if we gave kids free money instead of the corporations. Maybe, all right, maybe free gas for the kids. Never mind the education. Gas instead. Or better yet, we just give them liquor. You know, shots for tots, booze for books, liquor for stickers, you know, whatever. Whatever you want to call it. I've said from the beginning, where we're eventually going, where the radical right eventually wants to take us is, those kiosks that didn't work, where they're going to put those as vending machines in the grade schools and the lottery machines in the high schools. Cause hey, you know, over in the UK, 16-year-olds, they can buy lottery tickets. Why not here? I'm telling you, you're going to start hearing stuff like this. It is, and what blows my mind is that we're talking about funding our future on gimmicks, on vice spending, on bizarre schemes that we know are not going to work. But again, it's the shiny thing. It's over here. Over here! And with it being budget time, again, you know, I look at this as an opportunity to look at the morality of the people in power, our governor. I saw an op-ed over in the Patriot News written by Brendan Murray, who is a Harrisburg school board member, talking about what actually needs to be done instead of what our governor has done. Brendan, thanks for taking time for me.
Well, thank you for having me, Rick. I appreciate the time.
You know, I like the direction of your op-ed. It's the morality. This guy's morality over the last couple of years sliced what, almost $2 billion from public education, and now he's going to give pennies of it back. I'm sorry, I'm not buying it.
You know, it's funny that this comes from a governor who came from a school board. You know, he was a school director at one point in time, and yet now he fails to understand that, you know, the same situations that we're dealing with now, he would never want to deal with when he was back on the board.
Is it that he fails to understand, or just hey, I've got bigger fish that I've got to pay?
I think it probably has to do more with contributions than it does than voters. Because if you just look at the line of delineation of money, you can follow that straight from education, which is $2 billion that he's cut out, to the cracker plant that he's bringing in on the west part of Pennsylvania. It's the same exact amount of money that's going into the pockets of the oil and natural gas companies. And, you know, we'll still wonder down the line about the environmental aspects, but the actual economic aspects of this are going to be felt right away.
Oh, devastating, because, you know, I look at this, Brendan, and you're more intimately involved in this than I am. What we're doing to our education system, what we're doing to our schools is going to cost us a generation. Not just a year, not just a couple of months, an entire generation, I think, we're in jeopardy of losing.
Absolutely, and I couldn't completely agree with you more. The end of my article, I talk about the fact of the prisons being continued to be built up more one by one by one, and, you know, the money is going to go to privatization of those eventually. So we're just going to privatize and profitize everything, continue to go down the path of building prisons instead of building better schools. And, you know, it's pupils, you know, not prisoners, that we should be thinking of right now. And this is an unbelievable – the reason why I decided to bring it up about morality is because we are bankrupting the morality of the future of this state, let alone this area. And the only way that Harrisburg City itself gets back to the footing that it needs to is to have an educated workforce, because if we don't have the workers – no one's going to want to bring jobs here.
Yeah, and again, I go back to, you know, our governor talks a lot about creating jobs. He talks about, you know, the conditions and, oh, we need to be more business friendly and the reason the cracker plants because we believe in free markets, which is nonsensical on so many levels. People come to an area, as he said in his State of the State speech, because we're within a day's drive of 60% of the population of this country, yet we've got a crumbling infrastructure. People come for location, 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 and then education. I don't know where the handouts come in. I don't know where all of that other stuff. They come for location first. The cracker plant was going to be built there anyway, yet we gave our kids' future away for it.
Absolutely. And, you know, I've talked with a lot of architects in the city, and a lot of them have said to me point blank, you know, it isn't because we're not building good structures that people aren't moving back into the city. It's because of the fact that our school districts are bankrupt. They're unable to educate them at the funding that we receive. When we put up a budget, our budgetary slideshow last year, we showed a tree that looked worse than the Charlie Brown Christmas tree because of the amount of cuts that we've had to make in the past 3 years. And, you know, it's not going to get any easier. With the fact of the matter is with the sequestration that could possibly happen with our federal government, I'm worried about both. I'm worried about this budget, but I'm also worried about sequestration because if you look down the line, we're looking about possibly losing a lot of money for Head Start. And, you know, a lot of people will sit there and nitpick about Head Start and say that it doesn't work. The studies show that Head Start works. And the studies show that the sooner you get a child into an educated form, into a classroom, you're going to get huge results from this. And they call this this one part of the plan that they have is a maintenance of effort. Pretty much it's what you and I would consider an unfunded mandate. The federal government asks us that if we're receiving any federal funds that we have to do X, Y, and Z, they will give you the money to start off the program, but then because of the way that the economy has been, they've decided to take the money away. But if they're still giving you just a little bit of that money, they say that you have to.
Right.
You have to fund it out of your pocket. Now, I don't know where that I don't know what logic that comes from. And, you know, it sits there and bugs me to death because then our solicitor has to come up with a figure if this is actually even legal to continue to ask us as a district that continues to have to attacks the small percentage of the citizens of Harrisburg that can actually buy property and afford the property tax, you know, to actually have to pay more.
Yeah,
and
well, maybe we should be taxing. Maybe we should be taxing state government. Maybe we should be looking at taxing the property of nonprofits. Maybe we should start looking at where the money's at instead of saying, "Well, you know what? We don't have enough money. We might not be able to offer kindergarten. Oh, by the way, we might not be able to get the kids on the bus to get to kindergarten. But boy, those charter schools, we're going to set them up all right."
Absolutely, and you know, we just voted down another charter school the other day. I'm not sure if that's going to stand. We'll see in the future of whether or not that's going to come back up for another vote. We have another charter school on Tuesday that we have to vote for. And, you know, they are popping up. And this is a big jump for us. We had budgeted $6 million for charter schools this year. It actually was $8 million. Then it's going to jump to $14 million next year because all of the schools that have been approved are adding grades and adding more students, which means less money for the school district. Taking more funds out of the children, you know, it's as you say, and many times I've heard you state it, it is, you know, the Charlie in a chocolate factory, the whole golden ticket rule. And I'm tired of wondering where the money is going to come for the least fortunate, because some of these students that are going to the charter schools, they should have an opportunity for an education. I don't doubt that whatsoever. It just shouldn't be at the behest of everyone else.
Yeah, I agree with you, Brendan. But, you know, you brought up sequestration there a second ago, and it's, you know, that's just another part of all of the austerity that's being pushed on all levels of our government, mainly by Republicans, but a handful of Democrats as well. This whole idea that if we just cut to the bone, because, look, you know, we're at the bone. I mean, Scarnati, State Senator Scarnati the other day said, look, we're into the bone. Any more cutting, and you're going to be going through the bone.
Absolutely. And just to give you an example, if the sequestration does go through, we're going to lose 5.9% of our fiscal money coming from the federal government for 2013-2014. That means that for every $1 million that the federal government would give us last year, we would lose $59,000. Now, I mean, I don't know what it's going to take for the Republican Party to stand up and say, hey, listen, maybe we don't want to bankrupt our future on making political gains right now, but I'm tired of listening to them whine and complain about all of these things that our president has tried to pass, yet they don't seem to want to get up off their butts and do anything about it. It's so frustrating from a local level because all politics is local.
Right.
And when you sit there and you listen to them whine and complain, yet they don't seem to ever they never laid it on the president's lap and said, well, now he has to deal with it. This is his fault. I'm sorry, it isn't.
No, I agree. So what should we be doing? What's the answer to this? If you had the governor's ear, what should he be doing? I mean, we know what he's doing, but what should he be doing?
First of all, you should put the education funding back to where it was 2 years ago. I'm not even going to ask for 3 years ago. I'm going to ask for 2 years ago. That would give us $2 billion more in education. Secondly, you start creating jobs. He says he's the one that's going to create jobs. Well, that's all well and good for, you know, in the future, but I don't see them. We have, as you stated before, the crumbling infrastructure. Every time a worker gets a paycheck, there is taxable income there. When it comes down to you are a construction worker working on the infrastructure of our state that is so important because you got to get goods from one place to the other. And then that way it can get taxed. More people to work, more taxable income, more money for the state, more money for the federal government. That's how we get ourselves out of this, not by cutting. Austerity doesn't work. It's been proven over in Europe.
Yep. Absolutely. And we've got to stop doing it here. And this is another example, in my view, of a wrong-headed ideology that is going to, you know, they keep talking about how they care about the children. Oh, we're saddling them with debt. Yeah, we're saddling them with the debt of ignorance.
Absolutely.
And I mean, we're very reliant on Title I funding
right.
for our district, which is really to the heart of our special needs students. And I mean, they're going to be cutting a great deal. We've increased the disability. We have had a large increase of disabled children in our school district, but also statewide, about 16% in the past 10 years. And the funding for this is going to go dramatically down if we don't have, if we don't get this, if the sequestration goes through. We're talking about all the things that we were talking about last year, you know, cutting funding for sports, transportation, all of those things. It's a pittance compared to what we're going to lose if the federal government doesn't do what it needs to do and actually gets and passes a budget
yeah.
that's actually rational and takes care of its needy, takes care of its students, takes care of its people.
And I look at this, and again, you pointed to the sequestration, like a lot of the austerity, but the sequestration more than anything, that's self-inflicted. This is a crisis that was manufactured, and is, in my belief, as easy as they created it, they can uncreate it.
Absolutely. I mean, what we need to do, and I know you've said it quite a few times, is we need to get people out talking to their legislators. I mean, Senator Toomey, despite what everyone thinks about him, does listen to the voters. He will eventually come around if we flood his phones full of calls and send letters. They have to eventually listen because they're going to come back up for a vote.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
that's the number one way that we do it by voting.
Now, let me ask you, last line of questioning I've got for you
sure.
then. Because, you know, there's part of me, and I'm sure you've heard me say this before, there's part of me believes that the only time things change is when people are suffering. And my thought is how much of this has to go to the worst possible measure where we are in absolute pain and suffering before anything's going to get done.
I think that we're close to getting there. And with the fact that the state has brought a chief recovery officer into our school district, yet again the state stepping in, I hope that they start to wake up to the problems of the way that they're funding education. To the heart of all of this, we need to go and talk to the legislators and make them understand that this is vital
yep.
for our future. Forget next day, next year. We're talking about 30 to 40 years down the road and whether or not we're going to be able to be taken care of by the students that we're putting through.
That's an excellent point. And you talk about being competitive. What are we doing to the next generation of kids by underfunding their education? Brendan, I appreciate the time. I appreciate the passion. And keep up the great work there on the school board.
Well, thank you so much, Rick. I really appreciate your time, and keep up the good fight on your end.
Yeah, you're welcome back anytime. Brendan Murray, Harrisburg School Board member. Quick break. Back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425.
To the Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Buy the stuff you love with retailers' credit cards. Ditch their high interest rates with the help of PSECU. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit pseCU.com/visa for complete program details. Whatever new stuff you bought last year with retailers' high-interest credit cards, let PSECU help you get a fresh new start. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit pseCU.com/visa for complete program details. This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
Besides being founders of our republic, what did Thomas Jefferson and George Washington have in common? Answer, hemp. America's founders were strong promoters of this extraordinarily useful agricultural crop, and both Jefferson and Washington grew it. The first draft of our Constitution was written on hemp paper,
And as late as World War II, the government urgently pushed farmers to grow the crop as part of a Hemp for Victory program. So why are American farmers today prohibited from producing this patriotic, profitable, and pesticide-free plant? Political nuttiness. Most recently, in a frenzy of reefer madness, U.S. drug police decided that President Nixon's Controlled Substance Act of 1970 not only outlawed marijuana, but also its non-narcotic cousin, industrial hemp. If ignorance is bliss, they must have been ecstatic, yet their nuttiness remains the law of our land. The good news is that a wave of sanity is now wafting across America. In Colorado, for example, farmer Michael Bowman and Denver hemp advocate Linda Parker helped pass Amendment 64 in last fall's election. It legalizes personal pot use, which got all the media attention, but it also directs the legislature to set up a program for, quote, the cultivation, processing, and sale of industrial hemp. Bowman now hopes to be the first American farmer in generations to plant a legal crop of it, hoping to do so on April 30th, the 80th birthday of family farmer hero and hemp champion Willie Nelson. The red state of Kentucky is also on the move. Its Republican Ag Commissioner, backed by its Chamber of Commerce, is campaigning to legalize hemp farming there. And Kentucky Senator Rand Paul is co-sponsoring a national bill with Oregon Democrat Ron Wyden to take hemp off the controlled substance list. This is Jim Hightower saying, to help spread this seed, go to votehemp.com.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
They believe in teachers' unions. We believe in teachers.
What they do, they smile in your face. All the time they want to take your place. The backstabbers, backstabbers.
Yeah, I got to tell you, there's a guy who, at some point, it's going to have to happen. There's going to have to be a how-to book written about Christie. How do you exploit a good natural disaster? How do you use that for your own gain? I mean, a 74% approval rating in New Jersey with all of the things that guy's done, it's just mind-blowing. And as Andy pointed out in his email, he says, I'm losing hope. What are the people of New Jersey thinking? Christie's approval numbers, the man of, for, and about keeping the plutocrats happy and rich. Losing hope. And he is. I mean, he's their guy. He's going to make sure that the very well-to-do remain very well-to-do. And everybody else, well, what the heck with you? And investments in the future, not so much. But here again, that's going to be their guy in 2016. It's going to be the guy. Mark my words. Yeah, I go back to what Brandon was talking about there a second ago. And, you know, what blows my mind is you've got people who've got their heads in the sands. You know, last week we talked about, the president gave his speech about early education, pre-K programs, and they right away the right and their think tanks came out and said, well, you know, there's really no data that says that it's really all that great. And I'm telling you, the studies are there. I've got my own studies. I've got three of them at home. Those kids are, when they went to school, they're more advanced. My first grader was reading before he went to kindergarten. So was my daughter. My four-year-old is now reading sight words. Why? Because you've got a structured, this isn't rocket science. But you've got people like Representative Marsha Blackburn, the Republican from Tennessee who was on the Washington Journal on C-SPAN, I think it was Friday, where she said, you know, I think so many of our educators, when they hear about these programs coming from the federal government, they're just thinking, oh, that's just another book of paperwork that we're going to have to do. You know, because teachers, they're so weighted down with paperwork. And you go, yeah, from laws that you guys passed, the whole privatization, the whole industrialization of education. Well, we're actually talking about getting kids into some structured programs. You're against that. And she goes on to say, well, we want to have, you know, local and state control. I'm going, wait, I'm okay with that. Do it already. The reality is, look, you know, and I think it was the president who said, you know, for every dollar you spend on it, you save, what, $7? common sense. And, you know, I think he said it generates over a lifetime something like $11 of economic benefits over a child's lifetime. And I look at Fox Business, and this is what really just has me struggling. The good folks over at Fake News on Fox Business, the host Jerry Willis, was talking about, you know, this, you know, the president wanting to expand early childhood education, make it universal, make sure that everyone gets it. And her response was,
I have to tell you, I think it's immoral to make all these promises when you know at the end of the day you can't afford it, we can't afford it. To say preschool for everybody, are you kidding me? We don't have the money for that.
Preschool for everybody, are you kidding me? We don't have the money for that. Yeah, we do. We just don't have the priority for it. And I look at our governor here. We don't have the priority to fund education at the level it should be. The AP had a story this morning. Headline, Stanford University, first college to raise $1 billion. Evidently, they set a new fundraising record, $1 billion. 1 year of fundraising. Top five, Stanford, $1.035 billion. Harvard, $650 million. Yale, $544 million. University of Southern California, $492 million. Columbia, $490 million. The top 10 colleges in the country raised $5.3 billion. Overall, $3.1 billion were raised across the 3,500 accredited nonprofit schools in the country. You go, there's something seriously wrong when a handful who are charging outrageous tuitions are taking in that kind of money, and yet we're saying, well, we can't have early childhood education. Sorry, we can't. And there's part of me that says, you know why they think we can't have it? I knew a guy who worked for the Department of Public Welfare who had asked me a very pointed question. You advocate for all the people to get a good education. You advocate for everyone to graduate from high school. You advocate for people to go on into college or to trade schools. He said, which is a great, great thing. But what are you going to do with all these people when there are no jobs? Because we've got an economy that's pushing those kind of jobs overseas where we're seeking the lowest dollar. What are you going to do with an educated workforce who then says, I've done all I was supposed to do. I went to college. I got a good education. I've gone $1 trillion in debt. And there's no job. There's no middle class existence at the end of it. What do you then do? He said, all of a sudden, you know, if the Harrisburg School District was, instead of graduating 50 or 60%, graduating 95, 100%, what would you do with them? Who would you lock up? What would your justice system do? What would everything else that's dependent on having a working poor, what would you do? And there's part of me that goes, you know, these folks who, like this woman who says, well, you know, it's immoral to say that we can have these. Why give those people false hope? Like they can actually get a decent education. There's part of me says that this is, it's part of the plan. It's the design. Some people do really, really well if you can afford it. But everybody else? Well, screw you. I mean, I've always said the dividing line. Can you get a good quality education? Do you have job security? Do you have retirement security? And above all, do you have health security? And you look at what the Republicans have done with a handful of Democrats. They've gone after education. They've gone after retirement. They've gone after job security. And, well, we saw what they've done since the passage of Obamacare. This whole no rights at work agenda, this whole push towards creating and expanding a desperation class of low-wage workers who are dependent and pliable, and will buy the fact that, well, the job creator, he'll take care of us. It's mind-blowing. When we come back and talk about the Medicaid expansion, another governor looks to be taking it You'll be amazed when you come back. Quick break, right back after this.
With my microphone, I do a super show. I wear a cowboy hat, it is my business hat. I'm up till 1 a.m., I must tell you that. I'm a man with a mission.
The Rick Smith Show, teaching America for the better.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Buy the stuff you love with retailers' credit cards. Ditch their high interest rates with the help of PSECU. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/visa for complete program details.
Whatever new stuff you bought last year with retailers' high-interest credit cards, let PSECU help you get a fresh new start. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/visa for complete program details. This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
Earth, sky.
50,000 Quawer is a small, rocky world with its own moon, located in our solar system beyond the planet Neptune.
It's massive enough to be considered a dwarf planet, much as Pluto is now considered a dwarf planet. But the International Astronomical Union hasn't recognized Quawer as a dwarf planet just yet.
Astronomers discovered this object in 2002. It's extremely faint as seen from Earth. Its motion in front of the stars showed that it is closer to us than the stars, a member of our own solar system.
From the first, Quawer appeared relatively bright for such a distant object, but it was too small for even large telescopes to see in any detail. Astronomers were able to determine that it lies a billion kilometers beyond Pluto and moves around our sun every 288 years in a near-perfect circle.
NASA's Hubble Space Telescope was able to measure Quawer and found it to be 800 miles or 1,300 kilometers wide. That's about half Pluto's diameter. Its name, Quawer, is Native American from people in the area around Los Angeles where the discovery of Quawer was made. The name represents an ancient creator god.
Later, astronomers reported a moon for Quawer. The moon is estimated to have only 1/2000th the mass of its parent world. For more, come to EarthSky.org and search for Planet Beyond Neptune. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
We're at EarthSky.org.
Sanity for a change. The Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. So Rick Scott, the governor of Florida, evidently has decided with some conditions that they're going to accept the money from the federal government to expand the Medicaid program. But I don't know that it's such a great idea, this whole privatization scheme that they've tried. Evidently, they have tried it in five counties on a pilot situation. Not working out so well. They say it's rife with problems. In fact, advocates are saying that, you know, they're skimping on care. It's profit over people, man. But here again, the part of me looks at it goes, well, at least this guy's willing to consider covering some of his people. Not like our governor. I understand Florida has some of the strictest threshold levels in the country. In fact, for a parent with children to qualify for Medicaid in Florida, they have to make less than 22% of the federal poverty level wage. Less than 22%. Now, the federal law says 133% of poverty and you'll get covered. So I guess that's the negotiation. But we'll see as this rolls out. But here to talk to us about Pennsylvania and what our governor's done, I've got Athena Ford. She is the statewide staff member for the Pennsylvania Health Access Network, PAHealthAccess.org, their website. Athena, thanks for taking time for me.
It was almost so much fun to come on the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for having me back.
I always appreciate your time. You know, I look at this thing down in Florida. While I'm not fond of the idea of privatization or, as I call it, profitization, at least this guy's going, hey, we're trying to figure out how we at least cover some of the people, not like our guy here in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, it's undoubtedly still a step ahead of us in Pennsylvania. You know, Governor Kasich in Ohio, also a Republican governor, very similar state of Pennsylvania, like Pennsylvania, they moved forward. He came out in favor of the expansion. I don't understand what's been holding up our governor here. It's a win-win. I mean, this is going to, we're going to get $48 billion from the federal government to cover 700,000 uninsured working Pennsylvanians. We are going to cut our uninsured rate by over half. And what that doesn't just let hardworking families get the security that they need to know that they can have health care coverage when they need it. But it also saves taxpayers hundreds of millions of dollars that go to being spent in, you know, uncompensated care costs in the emergency room. It's going to create tens of thousands of jobs. It's going to stimulate local economies. It's going to bring in revenue. It's going to be a tremendous asset to the Pennsylvania economy, not just for working families. No idea why our governor is not jumping on this deal. Well, I mean, I do, and I think we all do. There's a lot of politics at play here. It's just unfortunate.
Yeah, how much of it is being chafed over the? He was one of the lead guys on the lawsuit that the Supreme Court turned back. And I got to be honest, there's part of me that says I don't want him setting up the exchange. I'll take my chances with the federal program. But this expansion of Medicaid, as you pointed out, there's absolutely no reason not to take this.
Right. The federal government's going to give us 100% federal financing for the first 3 years. Oh, my goodness, I'm sorry about the background noise.
That's right.
The federal government's going to give us 100% federal financing for the first 3 years. And then after that, the match rate is slowly going to go down. They are claiming, the Corbett administration is claiming, that there's going to be some additional cost to the state. And it's always true. If we want to enroll 700,000 new people into the Medicaid program, even if the federal government's going to give us all the money we need for the actual care, there's administrative costs attached, right? We might actually have to create a few good jobs to enroll people into the Medicaid program. But what they're pointing out is that a lot of those costs Pennsylvania's going to see anyway. The new healthcare law, Obamacare, already mandates that states simplify streamlining and enrollment, that you know, we're already going to be advertising, hey, guys, there's this big exchange. So people are going to be coming forward trying to sign up for benefits. I mean, it just makes sense to accept all of this money from the federal government to cover those people and to cover all the costs that we're going to incur anyway as a state.
And I think we're already paying as is. I mean, you know, you look at the fact that, you know, these folks who don't have health insurance, when they get sick, they still go to the hospital. When they fall and break a leg, they still go to the hospital. Someone's got to pay that.
Absolutely. And here's the real scary thing too. Not only do we pay that as individual taxpayers. So if we take this federal money and we, you know, enroll all these people in healthcare coverage, taxpayers are going to save over the next 10 years almost $900 million. So that'll be really good for us and our wallet. But it's also good for local economies, and it is good for the hospitals if we do this as well, because not only do taxpayers eat those costs, but the hospitals have to eat those costs. To help alleviate those costs, they get federal payments from the government. Those payments are cut back starting in 2014 because everybody thought folks were either going to be enrolling into Medicaid or going into the exchanges.
Right.
So if we don't enroll these people in Medicaid and what's happening, what you're describing continues to happen, you've uninsured people showing up in the ER needing urgent care, most likely when it was something that could have been prevented, then the hospitals are going to have to find a way to treat those people and pay for that, at the same time not getting the money to help alleviate those costs. This is going to force a lot of hospitals in Pennsylvania to either have to go under or lay off a significant number of workers. And if you look at Pennsylvania economy, right now in 67 counties, hospitals are one of the top five employers in 55 out of 67 of our counties. They're a major driver of our economic engine here in Pennsylvania. It's going to be devastating overall if we don't do this.
So it's good for our economy, it's good for the workers, it's good for the people. Again, I don't know why you're going to do it, but why you wouldn't do it. But I've got my friends who tell me, well, you know, it's socialism, Rick, don't you know? Oh, the government is taking over our health care. And I've read the thing. I'm not seeing the government taking over. These appear to me to be private plans, and they appear to me to be pretty much a nice handout, handout to the big insurers, in my view. Am I missing something?
No, I don't think so. To be honest, I think that we would, you know, be in better shape if all the plans were structured more of like, say, Medicare, for example, or Medicaid, which is extremely misconstrued right now. A lot of people think that it's not a good plan to have Medicaid coverage, when in reality, Medicaid coverage is something that's very highly valued by the people that have those plans. And usually, if you look at the value and the quality of those plans compared to a lot of the private sector plans, it's much better. And if you just take, for example, like an individual person who has to find health insurance on the individual market, how they rate their plan versus somebody who has Medicaid or somebody who has Medicare, usually they rate it much higher. If it was closer to what you're describing, we would probably be in better shape. It's definitely not a socialist type system that we're setting up here. It is very dependent on the private market, but it's also very dependent on the Medicaid expansion. The healthcare law was not written to be segmented out into two different parts. The Supreme Court totally threw us for a loop.
Yeah.
And so we really need to expand Medicaid in Pennsylvania for the law as a whole to work in our state.
So going back to what I said, you know, about, you know, Corbett being chafed about the fact that he was one of the very, you know, key guys in the lawsuit, is this kind of thumb in the eye, knowing that, look, you know, without the Medicaid expansion, the wheels could fall off the bus?
Yeah. I think, you know, it's the Medicaid expansion, like I said, that's going to help cover a lot of the uncompensated care costs. It's the Medicaid expansion that's going to help create a lot of the health care jobs that the new law is going to be creating in states. This is a vital piece of it for us. There's no doubt.
So what do we do? How do we get this guy on board? How do we get this pushed through? I mean, is it something that can be done around him? Is it something the legislature could do? How does this work?
Oh, that's my favorite question. So right now, for folks who have heard, and you guys have been covering it, and I'm sure listeners here have been seeing his budget address, he said, oh, I'm not recommending the Medicaid expansion at this time. Well, the legislature can choose to go ahead with it, with or without the governor. They have to put together their budget. And even though we're going to get all the money we need, or most of the money we need for this, from the federal government, it still needs to be appropriated in the state budget. So as folks know, that state budget fight is going on from now until June,
right?
The end of June, usually very last minute when we see that. So we want to do a full front fight around the legislature between now and the end of June, which means if you haven't yet called your state representative and your state senator and told them that Pennsylvania needs to accept billions of dollars in federal funds to expand health care coverage, to expand Medicaid, then please do that. Also, if this is a fight that's going to be moving very quickly, we are getting new job numbers coming up tomorrow. The strategy is going to be updated as far as targets and what comes next. So I do recommend, if folks are interested in taking part in this, that they sign up for our email alerts, and you can do that at pahealthaccess.org. If anybody wants to go the next level, write a letter to the editor, do that kind of thing, you think you're somebody who might qualify for the Medicaid expansion. If you think that you know of somebody who does, et cetera, we would love to talk to you. If you want to get engaged in the higher level, feel free to reach out to me anytime. My email address is aford@pahealthaccess.org.
And we'll make sure we get links at thericksmithshow.com so folks can do that. You know, because when we had done a food drive right about the time that the law was passed, and some of the things were going into effect. The high-risk pools had gone into effect, and I met a couple of people who they had benefited from the high-risk pools, and they were just so grateful to have some security. In fact, the one guy told me it saved his life because they had actually found cancer that he didn't know how he was going to get treatment for. Because, you know, they love to say, well, you know, we've got universal health care. You just go to the doctor and they have to fix you. And you go, yeah, if you break both your legs in the courtyard, sure. But if you've got diabetes, if you've got cancer, if you've got a long-term illness, there's no guarantee you're going to get the care that you need.
No, it's absolutely disgusting the way the system works right now. The hospitals need to treat you if it's life-threatening. And so, yeah, it's
a backwards way of doing
things. Part of my job is hearing these stories. But, yeah, I mean, if you show up at a hospital and you need, say, chemotherapy or something, you get turned down. You can't get treatment if you need it right now in this country unless you are working at a job that happens to offer you comprehensive health care coverage or you're married to somebody who does. Something, it's really the only option until 2014.
Something seriously wrong with that. The hope is that we are heading in the right direction. I don't think this is the end of this. This is just the beginning of this journey. And as we continue...
Here.
As you continue, I'd love to have you back, and you can fill me in on all the stories from the front lines.
Thank you so much. This is a lot of fun.
It's always great talking with you. Athena Ford, statewide staff member at the Pennsylvania Health Access Network, pahealthaccess.org, the website. Again, if you want to get involved, go to the website, and they'll hook you right up. Quick break, right back, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by AFSCME Council 13.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Buy the stuff you love with retailers' credit cards. Ditch their high interest rates with the help of PSECU. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/visa for complete program details.
Whatever new stuff you bought last year with retailers' high-interest credit cards, let PSECU help you get a fresh new start. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us.
Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit pseCU.com/visa for complete program details. This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
Exposing GOP hypocrisy, The Rick Smith Show.
Yeah, look at that. Another privatization scheme. Gee, you think that's ideology? You think that's their blind faith belief? Even though, you know, and as I was reading more of the story, you know, the reality is they've been trying this and it's not working. At least he's trying. At least in Florida, they're going to try and expand the Medicaid to make sure that upwards of 1 million people in Florida. I didn't realize that they had that many uninsured. A million plus would be covered by changing the threshold from 22% of the poverty level, which means that, you know, if, you know, a woman and a child, you'd need to make like $3,000 a year to qualify for their Medicaid. And now what the federal law does, what Obamacare does, it takes it up to 133% of poverty, which says, you know what? You work for minimum wage, you're going to get some health security. And I go back to the, you know, you cannot possibly be anywhere near the middle class without health security. And even with it, I don't know that you're really anywhere near it. Just blows my mind. But, you know, you look at all of this money that's out there, and they keep telling us, you know, we're broke, we can't afford this, can't afford it, no. Stanford raised over $1 billion in 1 year for their endowment. Sitting on how many billions? Just blows my mind. And you look at this latest piece written by Newt Gingrich, pointing his finger at Karl Rove. Evidently, Newty wrote a piece over at Human Events, you know, this conservative online newspaper, magazine, whatever it is. Basically saying that, you know, what Rove is doing is, you know, it's an invitation to cronyism, favoritism, and corruption. Because in case you didn't hear, Karl Rove has decided that, you know, the Tea Party route, that's run its course. It's done. That whole Crossroads GPS, you know, inflaming the insaniacs, that's done. We need to actually start thinking about, I don't know, some sanity. Well, he started this group called the Conservative Victory Project, and their goal is pretty simple. Get rid of these crazy Tea Party people because, one, they can't govern, and it's not good for society if you have people who are hell-bent on destroying the system. You can't manipulate the system. You can't win from the system if it's destroyed. And this is, you know, this is a very, very corporate mentality. And you know what? I think Newty's right. This is kind of the Tammany Hall style political machine, where you're going to have billionaires deciding who's going to run in each race and who they're going to fund. And it's going to come out of Rove's office. And you know, the reality is, you know, in Missouri and Indiana, where you had crazy right-wingers who lost Senate seats that should have been Republican seats, Rove is right. But is that the kind of politics we want, where billionaires decide? And this is where I kind of agree with Gingrich. It's the money. It's this consolidation. And you look at this lawsuit that was brought by the National Republican Committee. That's going to go to the Supreme Court. In fact, I guess it was heard the other day at the Supreme Court. You know, the people who brought you, you know, Citizens United, corporations are people, my friend. A lower court decided that the cap on individual contributions, $2,600 cap on individual donations to a single candidate, and the overall cap of $123,200 to candidates, political parties,
you know, similar type organizations. That cap was there. Well, what the Republican National Committee is arguing is that there should be no cap. If there's no cap on corporations, there's no cap on PAC money, there's no cap on that stuff, they can give as much as they want. Well, we should be able to give candidates as much as they want. So that we go back to what Gingrich is saying about Rove. See, Rove knows. He knows the big money and the power comes from controlling the purse that politicians need to go and dip their hand into. He knows that controlling what's in the trough when the little piggies come to eat, that's the power. And that's how they control things. And it's not just going to be Republicans, it's going to be all of them. Because look, Democrats, they need to raise money too. In order to be competitive, you need to raise a boatload of money. So the question is, what will our corporate Supreme Court do? Will they allow our system to be corrupted even further? Will they allow the billionaires, the Sheldon Adelsons? And I find it ironic that it's Newt Gingrich who's out there saying, Karl Rove's trying to build this Tammany-style, Hall-style political machine. Billionaires are gonna run elections across the country when his billionaire, Sheldon Adelson, was going to spend $100 million to make him president. Kind of interesting if you think about it. But you look at this Supreme Court case. If this gets thrown out, and there's no limit on what the wealth class can do. What will they do? How much power and how? I mean, there's some who say, you know, that there's not much difference between the Republicans and the Democrats. There'll be no difference because they're going to have to beg from the same handful of people. Because as we're seeing this theft of wealth from the working class of this nation to go into the hands of the handful, that's where the money's at, folks. And is that the political system that we want? Do we want a political system based on NASCAR-type politics? Which billionaire logo you've got on your jacket? How much cash you can raise from those handful of investors? Because it's no longer about donations. It's about investing. They need a return on their investment. It's mind-blowing. And it's all going to be about bowing to the court. You want to talk about fascism? It's right there. And you look at our political system. There's a swinging door going back and forth. People from government to private industry and back and forth and back and forth. And there's no movement to stop that. Or at least none that is viable. Why? Because they don't have the money. But the billionaires, they've got it. And they fund the people like Rove and people like Gingrich. When I read the story, my first thought was, you know, I guess they're not paying his bills. He ran up a bunch of bills during the election. I guess they're not paying that. He's a little chafed. Anyway, I'm going to take a quick break. When we come back for the third hour, just more money. It's all about the swinging door and the amount of campaign cash that is buying our system. Just a damn shame. Quick break, back after this.
Sanity for a change. The Rick Smith Show.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
The U.S. Supreme Court may decide if workers should be compensated for the time it takes to change clothes.
On Tuesday, the highest court in the land agreed to hear a case brought by 800 workers against a U.S. steel plant in Gary, Indiana, where the court will determine the meaning of changing clothes. Attorneys for U.S. Steel argue that clothes changing, even if required to perform certain duties, isn't covered under the Fair Labor Standards Act. This isn't the first time a court has heard such a case, with judges coming down on all sides of the issue. Often, it comes down to what constitutes clothing. Due to the myriad of rulings, it's up to the Supreme Court to determine what items of safety wear are considered clothing and whether or not compensation is legally required. Even with the economy slowly turning around, college students are one of the demographics having the hardest time finding new jobs. Leilani Albano reports.
Coming out of college, Erin Foote could not find stable work and had little money. So, she lived in her car.
Luckily, I have seats that lay down, so I could make one into kind of like a bed. And then in the back, I have a pretty big back space, so I kept my clothes and belongings there.
Today, more than ever, college graduates are finding themselves in dire economic straits. About 48%, or 1.5 million college grads under 25 years old, are underemployed or unemployed, according to a new study by the Center for College Affordability.
It was just sad because I felt like I went and I put all this work into a great degree. I worked so hard, and yet I couldn't find a job.
The lack of educational return can partly account for their precarious situation. While a third of all adults in the U.S. have bachelor's degrees, a center study reports that college graduates are taking jobs that only require a high school diploma. This has left more college grads finding work in the low-paid service and food preparation sectors. The trend began as collapsing financial markets stopped investing in job creation. Robert Hilton Smith is policy analyst for Demos, a research center that studies economic and democracy issues.
Basically, instead of corporations reinvesting profits in jobs and in hiring and in communities, we've really seen them instead hoard this, just basically hoard this money or put it back into the financial markets instead. And a lot of this is because we don't have unions aren't there to kind of counterbalance the power of corporate boards or corporate management in general.
This report was made possible in part by a grant from the Burger Marx Foundation.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Demanding the super rich to pay their fair share for once. The Rick Smith Show.
Latest trend to name by race and hate.
Back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. So it looks like Blanche Lincoln has found herself a new job after leaving the Senate, or, well, not leaving, being ousted. The former Arkansas senator is with the law firm of Alston and Byrd. She's now been hired as an outside consultant to Wally World. She's now going to be one of their front guns on the gun debate. Also, Walmart brought on Teresa Wang. She is she's going to be lobbying on food and general business issues, according to the report. She served as the legislative director for both Sandy Adams, the Republican representative from Florida, and Louis Gohmert, the Republican representative from Texas, both of them on the House Judiciary Committee. Gee, I wonder. And you look at this swinging door back and forth. The government, the private industry, back and forth. And you go back to the Clinton years, you see now the former deputy chief of staff to Clinton, who then became president of the Walmart Foundation. I guess she's about to be nominated for the Office of Management and Budget. Here to talk to me about that, our good friend Lee Fong. He's written a great piece over at The Nation, Obama's top choice for OMB, led Walmart's foundation's targeted giving. Lee, thanks for taking time for me.
Hi, Rick. How are you?
I am good. You know, I look at this, and to me, it's another one of those moments where, you know, I keep hearing my friends say, you know, Obama's a socialist. I keep seeing him putting corporatists in charge of our government.
Well, that's right. And, you know, I heard you just talking about Blanche Lincoln, and I like the term of art they used, outside consultant. You know, everyone's kind of afraid of the L word. No one wants to say it. No one wants to call it how it is. No one wants to describe themselves as a lobbyist. But that's what they're doing. And here with the potential nomination of Sylvia Matthew Burwell to head the OMB, she's the head of the Walmart Foundation. But our piece, I wrote this piece with Josh Idelson, a fantastic reporter. He and I looked at the foundation, and a lot of what they do is actually lobbying for Walmart. So in essence, this could be another member of the Walmart lobbying team in the upper echelons of government. In fact, a cabinet level post.
Yeah, you know, but you know, I've looked at this and I read your piece, and it's fantastic. We've got a link over at thericksmithshow.com for folks who want to take a look at the Nation piece. But you know, I've always said that it's the propaganda arm. You know, and I remember, you know, you see all of these stories about the great work that Walmart does, like after Hurricane Katrina. You know, they said, I think it was something like $8 million worth of water. You saw the line of trucks going down with water for the folks in New Orleans, but they spent $18 million promoting the fact that they did it.
That's right. And, this, you know, folks have talked about how Walmart is the pioneer in union busting and cost cutting, that sort of thing. But what's less discussed is how Walmart has been a real pioneer in this so-called corporate responsibility lobbying. And they're doing exactly what you're talking about. They're finding out, they figured out that it's actually a better use of their marketing money to contribute to laudable causes, you know, funding disaster relief or, you know, food banks and what have you.
Or schools. I mean,
improve the image.
Or schools. I mean, they're one of the biggest funders of moving towards charters and privatized education. They fund a lot of that.
That's right. And this kind of approach, you know, it all kind of started in 2006. Their chief lobbyist, Leslie Dock, he was a big Democratic Party honcho, big Democratic Party operative fundraiser. He was brought on to Walmart to improve their image among Democrats, progressives, liberals. And what he did was say, look, let's use our charitable arm to our advantage. Let's pump more money into it, and let's forge alliances on the left. So they started giving lots of money to kind of the establishment civil rights community, giving money to the Organization of Chinese Americans, the NAACP, Urban League, what have you, Latino groups. Basically, they're trying to do is, they're trying to isolate labor. They're trying to say all you groups on the left, whether you're with women's organizations, you're with Asian Americans, whatever, support us. We'll give money to you. Just don't be friendly to labor. Don't support the Employee Free Choice Act. Be quiet when big protests happen, like the one last year. And you know, at the end of the day, it seems to be working for them.
Well, I mean, you know, that's how you do it. You buy off your enemies. And look, I mean, isn't that hard to figure this out? You know, when a good portion of your budget is dependent on them, are you going to say anything when the time to speak up comes around? Of course not.
They've sowed these relationships very deep in Washington. And what's interesting here, Leslie Dock, that chief Walmart lobbyist I was just mentioning, he's the one who actually helped hire Sylvia Burwell. Burwell reports to Doc at Walmart. So there's no separation between the philanthropy and the corporation. And that's what's a little bit troubling here because, you know, one would hope that when Burwell, if she is nominated and confirmed, that she becomes a loyal public servant and serves the public interest.
Right.
But it is troubling because we've seen example after example after example of so many corporate lobbyists and corporate types borrow into government, serve their corporate master while being a public servant, and then going back for the revolving door, just as you were saying.
Yeah, well, let me ask you, what does the Office of Management and Budget, what's their authority? What is it, if she was into this position, how would it benefit Walmart?
Well, it's probably the most powerful cabinet-level agency that no one's ever heard of. It's not very well known outside the Beltway, but in addition to helping craft and analyze the federal budget, for the White House. They have the power to review every single federal regulation coming out from any of the agencies to work with different stakeholders and in some cases block regulations or take those regulations back to the agency and rework them. So, you know, obviously this could be a big boon to Walmart if Burwell does oversee some type of labor regulation that they're afraid of or something coming out of one of the other agencies. I mean, we've looked at the lobbying disclosures, and Walmart is very interested in the OMB. They have lobbied it in the past. Are there issues in the immediate future that Walmart would want to lobby on? It's not 100% clear, but we have another 4 years of the Obama administration. Right. It's sure to become an issue for them.
How about the health care law? I mean, is there anything in this that would be beneficial with her in that position for the Walmarts of the world?
And, you know, that's possible. I wouldn't be able to speak on that, but there are certain issues in terms of employers contributing to plans and what they expect employees to contribute that might be affected. But again, I couldn't tell you.
Well, let me ask you this, Lee, because there are some who would say, you know, all of the good deeds that Walmart does, all of the philanthropy, all of the charity, that's just out of the goodness of their heart. You know, they're a very profitable company. And they're just trying to give back to charity, you know, like the commercial says.
Well, sure. I mean, and that's, you know, here's the interesting thing. We looked at a transcript that Doc, the Walmart guy, gave at an investor conference, and he made it very clear. Look, we're doing all these good things in the community, but at the end of the day, this is what's coming back to us. Maybe, I don't remember the exact year, but I believe it was 2007, 2008. Their numbers with self-described moderates and liberals were very low. Within just a couple years of this type of corporate philanthropy, it had ticked up 30 points. They're now very popular among even self-described moderates and liberals. And then he made the explicit connection to the Employee Free Choice Act. And this transcript was from a conference in 2010. He said, look, that bill is dead. And he connected it to that type of philanthropy. So these connections matter. And, of course, again, back to Blanche Lincoln, she was one of the people who helped kill that bill in the Senate and made it dead on arrival in 2009. So this is all part of their influence operation. And unfortunately, it's kind of hard to report on because, you know, who could be against delivering water after Hurricane Sandy, right? I mean, no one's against that.
Nope.
But you have to see what their real agenda is.
And who could be against saving puppies or bringing apple pie to mom? Who could be against any of that stuff?
Exactly.
But, you know, here's the one thing that Walmart and big corporations do understand. It's not just Walmart that does this. It's just that Walmart does it better than everyone, and they've got a lot more money, is they understand return on investment. To them, this is, as you pointed out, an investment in their image, an investment because they want those consumers to come. They want people like me who are going to go, oh, yeah, well, you know, they don't pay their workers very well, and they don't give them health insurance, and their pension sucks. But at least, you know, they help the puppies.
I've seen oil companies funding minority groups to try to buy off their support on climate change legislation. We've seen chemical companies getting into trouble and then trying to buy off folks. We've seen medical device companies that are kind of buying surrogates to say that their products aren't hurting people when they, in some cases they are. So this is kind of like a standard tactic, but what makes Walmart unique is that they're just so much bigger. They're able to throw their weight around and really just buy public opinion. And that's kind of the other aspect of this piece. The Burwell nomination is one part, but just the kind of level of outreach is pretty phenomenal. Even in really respectable and honorable organizations like NAACP, we found a website launched by Walmart that was promoting quotes from the NAACP chapter leader in New York City saying, yes, please, we'd love a Walmart in Brooklyn. That's a very contentious issue. But there's no disclosure there that just in 2011, Walmart was coming in and sponsoring that same person giving that quote, giving lots of money to the NAACP. And that's a really troubling kind of pattern that we're seeing all over the country.
And the thing is you look at the amount of money that they're giving to those different groups, it's not an awful lot. I mean, you're talking pennies for the investment. And I go back to the return on investment. They know the pennies that they're handing out is going to pay huge dividends down the road.
That's right. I mean, Walmart has I don't believe it's the largest corporate philanthropy, but it's among the top 10. It fluctuates. In the last couple of years, I think it was among the top five. So they've got hundreds of millions to give away. And we've seen it go not just to these kind of laudable organizations, but really random ones. Friends of the NRA, they gave a grant to the State Department. I mean, they have the resources to buy friends everywhere. And sometimes it's not with an explicit, you know, we need, and I just gave the case of the positive quote, welcoming Walmart to New York City from the NAACP. In other cases that we've looked at, it's buying silence. It's getting folks to just sit on their hands. So, you know, it's difficult to look at because sometimes, you know, people don't see it as traditional lobbying, but this is buying a reputation. And dollars can go much farther rather than buying a billboard or a TV advertisement. Rather, partnering with local stakeholders can enhance one's reputation in a community.
Oh yeah, I mean, if you're for local puppies, you know, people will love you, and oh, we'll get the kids in, and oh, well, God, I see it in my kids' school all the time, the corporate advertisers and the corporate good deeds that go out to influence not only their future purchasing habits, but oh, they're such good companies. Oh, they're so wonderful. So benevolent. Love that word, too.
Right, they're benevolent. They only care about the community.
Yeah. But, you know, the thing that ticks me off, Lee, is, you know, the Democratic Party, who some would like to believe is, you know, the party of the working people. And you look at another scenario like this. I mean, who's Obama putting in these positions? I mean, wasn't Jack Lew the guy before who's now going to be Treasury Secretary, who's no different than Geithner or any of the other ones? And I heard Commerce Secretary Penny Pritzker, really a billionaire. It just blows my mind.
Well, I mean, Lou, I mean, there's an interesting story that caught my attention the other day. Someone was looking a little bit closer at his financial disclosures when he entered the Obama administration, and he received a big bonus in, I believe, January 2009 to leave Citigroup.
Yeah.
You know, you look at any other normal job, who gives you a bonus to leave?
A lot of them, a lot of the CEOs. I mean, you go back to Home Depot when they showed Robert Nardelli the door. They gave him $210 million because he had a contract.
That's a good point. I mean, those are high level executives, but he went into government and that bonus could pay off because he'll be in a position to possibly dole out favors to his former firm. And you know, the nature of the revolving door is that even if you aren't given a big bonus or a big sack of money before you go into government, you can see one or you can expect one when you're leaving if you've done the right thing for certain corporate interests. You know, in this Burwell case, it's difficult to say because she clearly has the qualifications. She used to work at the OMB. She was deputy chief of staff in the Clinton administration. But her connections to Walmart, I mean, hopefully these are brought up in the confirmation hearings if she is nominated.
No, I don't think we'll see the Republicans go after her the way they've gone after other nominees. So let me ask you a last question I've got. You know, you look at this revolving door. Is there any way to stop this? I mean, I've yet to find anyone who really can defend, you know, starting off in government, going into private industry, making a ton of money, coming back, and just having this circle of people, of their buddies regulating their other buddies, and nothing ever gets regulated.
Look, this is a difficult issue to police, but, you know, personally, I've looked at this. You know, some states have tried to enact waiting periods, saying you can't become a lobbyist, you know, for 2 years after leaving government. And that just doesn't work because folks become, you know, quote unquote consultants instead of lobbyists.
Right.
Personally, I think this issue could be resolved a little bit better. We just had more transparency and more DOJ investigations. This type of corruption, if it is prosecuted at a criminal level, it could scare off folks from doing this in the future. We just haven't seen the Obama administration putting any kind of serious investigative resources to prosecuting this type of corruption.
Or any of the Wall Street corruption or any of the stuff that I still think we should be locking people up after the collapse in 2008, but that's probably not going to happen either, because here again, they're all feeding at the same trough, and it infuriates me beyond belief, because this is the guy I voted for, and this is the guy that, you know, I wanted to see do well, and I see this, and it angers me.
I hear you, Rick.
Lee, it's always great talking with you. I appreciate the time. You got to come back more often.
Hey, thank you so much. It was a real honor being here.
Thanks so much. Quick break, right back. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Who cares about the deficit? We want a glorious war. Or was it a shell game from the master of the cloak and dagger?
You're listening to the Rick Smith Show.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Besides being founders of our republic, what did Thomas Jefferson and George Washington have in common? Answer: hemp. America's founders were strong promoters of this extraordinarily useful agricultural crop, and both Jefferson and Washington grew it. The first draft of our Constitution was written on hemp paper, and as late as World War II, the government urgently pushed farmers to grow the crop as part of a Hemp for Victory program. So why are American farmers today prohibited from producing this patriotic, profitable, and pesticide-free plant? Political nuttiness. Most recently, in a frenzy of reefer madness, U.S. drug police decided that President Nixon's Controlled Substance Act of 1970 not only outlawed marijuana, but also its non-narcotic cousin, industrial hemp. If ignorance is bliss, they must have been ecstatic, yet their nuttiness remains the law of our land. The good news is that a wave of sanity is now wafting across America. In Colorado, for example, farmer Michael Bowman and Denver hemp advocate Linda Parker helped pass Amendment 64 in last fall's election. It legalizes personal pot use, which got all the media attention, but it also directs the legislature to set up a program for, quote, the cultivation, processing, and sale of industrial hemp. Bowman now hopes to be the first American farmer in generations to plant a legal crop of it, hoping to do so on April 30th, the 80th birthday of family farmer hero and hemp champion Willie Nelson. The red state of Kentucky is also on the move. Its Republican Ag Commissioner, backed by its Chamber of Commerce, is campaigning to legalize hemp farming there. And Kentucky Senator Rand Paul is co-sponsoring a national bill with Oregon Democrat Ron Wyden to take hemp off the controlled substance list. This is Jim Hightower saying, to help spread this seed, go to votehemp.com.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
As far as my 2008 compensation goes, it was for my work in 2008. I do believe that it was comparable to compensation for people in positions like mine in the industry.
Yeah. Could you tell us how much money you made in 2008 before you got the bonus?
My base salary, I believe, was $350,000.
Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Yeah, $350,000 base salary. I guess walked out with $1 million as he was leaving the door. And it's an interesting way to look at it. That Lee, you know, kind of implied there that it was hey, here's a nice going away present as you're going to do the job of overseeing us. Make sure you think of us kindly. Really, I've yet to meet anybody on any of the political. On either side of the political divide, who can make a rational, cogent argument for why we need to have this revolving door. Now, there have been some who say, you know, the financial industry is very, very complex. very difficult to understand. You need to have the latest, greatest, best minds to do this stuff. You know, because I go back to Greenspan, who said that the reason that they didn't regulate derivatives is it was a complex financial instrument, and that, you know, regulators just couldn't understand it. Evidently, they didn't. The smart people didn't understand it either. And if it's that complex that it can't be regulated, it shouldn't exist. But that's a whole nother discussion for a whole nother day. And I look at this and I go, you know, this swinging door, this is really what people look to Washington and say, there's something wrong. Or at Harrisburg or anywhere where you've got government becoming an arm of a corporation. And they got a word for it. It's fascism. It is what it is. And I'm not saying that to inflame or incite. It's simply what it is. It's corporate-run government. And when you keep hearing the Republicans say, well, we need to run government more like a business, this is what you get. You get the Jack Lews, you get the Penny Pritzkers, you get these folks who, they come and go. And especially these lobbyists. You know, I love the Blanche Lincolns of the world. All the politicians. It doesn't matter. Political stripe doesn't matter a bit. Some of the people that I've respected the most over the years. Once they're out of office, what do? They go where the money is. It's time to cash in on those connections. And that's what it's all about. And it's the people who have the money. It's the Walmarts of the world who have the cash to go and buy. And, you know, it just disgusts me when you hear all of it. And Lee's piece, you know, goes through a number of different groups who I think started out for all the right reasons and I think do some really fantastic work. But like a lot of, they need money. So for a couple of bucks, not even a lot, they'll keep their mouth shut. They'll say a nice word. They'll invite the Walmart people to their functions. Oh, how wonderful. Thank you. They'll give them an award. Oh, you're such great humanitarians. You at this foundation that bears the Walmart name. Or any corporation or any benevolent organization. And what do you end up getting? Look, Walmart didn't get to be the biggest corporation in the world, the most profitable in the world, by being stupid. I go back to what the old man always said. If a rich person takes a buck out of his pocket to tell you you don't need something, you better spend two to get it. So when Walmart takes a buck out of their pocket and says, you don't need that Employee Free Choice Act. You don't need those labor laws. You don't need whatever. You better damn well believe you do need it. Which is what really, really frustrates me. Because the question becomes, you know, when we're inundated by message, and I think of my kids who, you know, they come home and this restaurant chain has given them a, hey, you read 5 books, okay, you get a free kids meal. Or, you know, you get a free this or a free that, or, oh, hey, there's this folder with our name on it. Oh, we're a wonderful, benevolent company. Well, we're so good in the community. And I hate to be so jaded that I go, you know, they're not doing this for any reason other than pure profit and pure return on investment. You know, somewhere in there, there's got to be a beating heart that says, you know what, we're doing this for the betterment of the community. But then again, look, corporations are not people, my friends. They don't have a beating heart. Purely and simply about the bottom line. How much coin they can put in their pocket. You, me, my kids, be damned. And what angers me is it really is a very meager amount. It really is. And I think back to that moment after Hurricane Katrina where you saw every news agency, and you know they had a team of PR people working on that visual. And you know they found the cameraman the perfect spot to get that picture of all the Walmart trucks lined up. You know, and look, they're not the only one who does, so don't think I'm just picking on them. This is what happens. This is what happened to our country. We have been advertised to. We have been PR'd to. We have been propagated to. This is just the way it is. And it's going to take us to be vigilant and say, you know what, we're not buying it anymore. Enough. So when they spent, in the story that I read, they spent $8 million in donations. That's what it cost them to take all these truckloads of water down to the people in New Orleans. And they spent $18 million promoting the fact that they took $8 million worth of water down to New Orleans. And we said, oh, what a wonderful company. Now, understand, you paid for that. They wrote that all off, of course. It was a charitable thing. That wasn't free. And that's the other thing that infuriates me. They write this stuff off while having one of the lowest tax rates in the world. Oh, I know, Rick, we got the highest. Except when you look at all of the loopholes and all of the ways to hide and shield. And we pay for that. Now, if we did have that high rate, I'm all in favor of incentivizing. Believe in loopholes, but you got to have a high rate for it to actually work. And you go back and you look at, and I just had this conversation with my very wealthy uncle, who said, you know, I said, look, I'm not against loopholes for you. I'm not against incentivizing you to do certain things, but there's got to be a tax rate that says if you don't, there's got to be some punishment for it, because we're giving corporations as much as they can pocket. You know, trickle-down economics meant at some point their pockets would full, their bellies would be full. Something would trickle down. Something would fall off the table. Something would happen. But as we see, increasingly, nothing's coming down. The trickle ain't happening. In fact, not only did they take 100% of all the new income since the Great Recession, they've taken 121%. So the crumbs that you were getting, maybe, possibly, they're snatching those back. And I don't know how any working person in this country can go, oh, well, things are going the right way and we want more corporatists. Michael told me, well, Obama's to blame for all of this stuff. And I'm going, Obama's not to blame for everything. I'm not thrilled with some of the things that he has done. Appointing these people to these positions infuriates me, angers me to no end. Jeffrey Immelt, your jobs are a guy who's outsourced millions. Really? But then there's part of me that steps back and goes, you know, the guy's in a tough spot. Because if he doesn't do that, they crash the economy. Because we have given them that kind of power. Because they know all they got to do is put a PR campaign out there, put a little ad out there, say how wonderful they are, what kind of job creators they are. And it's that evil black guy in the White House who's making them not create jobs. And maybe it is our education system has failed us and we're going to buy it. Something seriously wrong about that. Quick break when we come back. Talk Radio News Service. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Exposing that free trade is never free. The Rick Smith Show.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by AFSCME Council 13.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2000.
1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. Got an email from Ann who pointed out a story from guys on a plane. Gets all liquored up, decides, well, that baby that's crying, I'm just going to reach over and smack him. Yep. Joe Ricky Hundley, the former president of, and former, because he was fired right afterwards, the former president of Unitech Composites and Structures on a flight out of Idaho there. Baby was crying, decided, you know what, just reached over and smacked it, and then told the mother to shut that, well, use the dreaded N-word, baby up. The white parents, very, very, very shocked, very shocked. And he faces up to a year in prison for smacking a 19-month-old, my 19-month-old baby. I had perfect CEO beating up on the little kids. Nuts. I hope he gets the year, and I hope they treat him just as well. Anyway, to find out what's going on around the world and in Washington, D.C., I've got Luke Vargas, Talk Radio News Service. Luke, thanks for taking time for me.
Yeah, of course. Thank you.
So you think smack 19-month-old baby, good thing, bad thing?
Oh, geez. I don't even think I can comment on this because it'd be inappropriate to lapse into comedy.
I mean, because I think about it, if it was my kid, they would not be charging Joe Ricky Hundley. They'd be charging Rick Smith because I'd have killed him. Right there and then.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Just absolutely nuts. So what's going on in the world?
Well, at the UN today, which is my beat here, I'm always looking for reasons to confirm why it is I left Washington. And there are sometimes some opportunities at the United Nations when certain world leaders come through and make it all worth it. And today, to celebrate, to mark the UN celebration of the Year of Quinoa, which is that strange little sort of fake grain that has become very popular in American cuisine over the past few years. The president of Bolivia, who's a socialist, Evo Morales, was at the United Nations, and he used the opportunity to mark the Year of the Quinoa to give a speech where he really just went on a tear against a big agriculture of multinational corporations who he says are trying to get rid of local diets around the world and force corn and wheat down people's throats, and he really turned what to me seemed like a very dry event into something that was really just full of both comedy and some pretty cool politics.
Yeah, so I guess tomorrow I'll be hearing about now Evo Morales in the same breath with Hugo Chavez.
Right. Well, he did a press conference after the event this evening. And he was just sort of throwing out some interesting, news items that the international media was not aware of. And one of the things he admitted was that he had tried to go to the hospital where Hugo Chavez, the leader of Venezuela, is sick. He's being treated for cancer. And he said he tried to go in there and visit him, but that they turned him away because of Mr. Chavez's health. So just a little tidbit that everyone ran with, and that was sort of the evening news item from this whole day at the UN, but I don't think it was the most interesting thing even said.
No, so what was?
I think, generally speaking, just the comedy inherent in a whole year dedicated to honoring a grain. Again, it's not going to play as well on the major networks, but it's one of those funny issues where the United Nations seems to create opportunities for people to come and give a rant at the biggest podium in town, and that's exactly what Evo Morales did today. And he called the Security Council the Insecurity Council, and in front of all the United Nations officials, said that the invasion of Libya last year was motivated by profit. So he really went on a tear against the institution that had given him the opportunity to speak there. And for that, I was very grateful to have the United Nations as my beat today.
Yeah, I mean, you look at that, and it gives people the opportunity to poke the big guy in the eye and really not get beat up immediately.
Sure. He was saying that, he had been petitioning to have quinoa be recognized this year, but that countries like the United States and major corporations such as McDonald's and Bank of America had been petitioning the Secretary General to make it something else because they didn't want, they see quinoa as a threat to their hold on profits. And, you know, he's certainly, you know, shaking up the waters.
Yeah, I honestly don't even know what quinoa is.
You look it up. It's something that's quite popular here in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, the hipster capital of the world. And as I was taking the ferry into work today, some women and this child asked me what I was going to be working on at the UN. And I said, oh, you probably won't know anything about it, but they're honoring quinoa today. And they said, oh, you don't say, because we were soaking it overnight in order to unlock its full nutritional potential. And we serve it all the time in our vegan household. So it's an issue and a grain that is known to many, but not everyone.
Yeah, well,
for sure.
Obviously not me. The thing I think about when you brought up Bolivia is I think about the privatization of their water system years ago and the whole fight over that. And, you know, because we're going through the same thing here in the U.S., just a lot slower than that. But, you know, whenever I think of Bolivia, I think of Bechtel and the whole water privatization.
Well, his privatization scheme is continuing, or rather his nationalization of utilities is continuing at a rapid pace. Just a few days ago, he announced that he was going to be nationalizing Bolivia's three largest airports, and that follows, I believe last year he nationalized electric utilities as well as taking over the charters of a number of mines in the country. So he's certainly practicing what he preaches. And if you want to look at a dynamic popular leader who's governing with a socialist ideology, he's a guy to turn to. And it was really just fascinating to even be in the room with him and see how he acts. He's an interesting guy.
Yeah, it must have been an interesting speech, and I have to look it up. On the international front, another attack, I guess, by the Chinese on our cybersecurity. What's going on this front?
No particular attack, but what there was is yesterday there was a report by Mondiant, which is an online monitoring company, and they really did some digging into these coordinated attacks we've been seeing against newspapers, corporations, I guess Dow Chemical, Ford Motors, GE, a number of American companies have been reporting that their internal networks have been compromised by hackers in recent months, and that it's resulted in billions of dollars in lost trade secrets. Basically, Chinese hackers, it's assumed, have been cutting costs and going to the American corporations that have this incredible technology, stealing their trade secrets, their intellectual property, if you will, and then, passing it along to Chinese state corporations that go and implement some of the things that we've worked so hard and invested so much money in creating. So this report basically pointed a finger at the building that was about 40 miles outside of Shanghai in China, saying that they believe there are thousands of people inside this unmarked building that has a whole bunch of guards stationed in front of it. And it's believed to be linked to the People's Liberation Army of China, where the very advanced hacking operation is located. So a pretty damning report, and it has the Chinese government on its heels.
Yeah, but you know, they would never do that. They believe in free markets, Luke. Come on, they believe in capitalism. They would never do anything underhanded like that, would they?
Well, they turned around and pointed the finger at us, saying that, you can't really deny the numbers that China is responsible for the most cyber hacking incidents in the world, but they said, look, the United States does it to us. You're the number two in the world. Russia is actually a close third. But their response is that, and it's something that everyone is doing now, not a very good excuse or way to prove that you're not guilty, but they're saying it's just a common practice in this digital world.
So it's everyone's doing it. We're just better at it.
Sure. And they're using lots of different methods. When they can't do sort of hacking, what's been happening a lot is that Chinese companies hire workers who are disgruntled with their American companies. And, you know, for a few thousand dollars more per year, they get them to cough up really millions of dollars worth of patents and insider information. And then they run with that information. So it's a really complex issue. And the United States, the White House today released a report saying how they're aiming to deal with this issue, but yet it doesn't really seem like the United States has anything we can do about this just because we want to. They said they're going to do a public awareness campaign about international cyber hacking, but I'm not sure what an awareness campaign is going to do to stop these very advanced hackers.
Yeah, I don't know either. But you know, I had talked to an inventor several months back who he had his patent stolen, and the product that he was making, manufactured here in Pennsylvania, ended up being copied identically in China by an American company, oddly enough. And he said, look, you know, you steal something from a movie, the FBI comes and gets you. You steal my patent, it's a civil case. And his suggestion was you make the patents just like the copyrights and put some people in jail.
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting suggestion. But as we know from, you know, just how much angst American film and music industries have about intellectual property theft and copyright infringement in China, those cases would join an already very long backlog of claims against certain Chinese individuals. So I'm not sure exactly how much more effective that would be compared to the current system. But certainly we're going to need every idea we can summon to fix this problem.
Yeah. Well, again, as this guy pointed out, it's millions of jobs we're losing because of it. So it is that important. And finally, Jesse Jackson Jr. got himself in a bind, I guess, huh? Dipping his hand into the cookie jar?
Oh, boy, did he ever. This is another Illinois politician who's been up to some bad stuff. He, over the past few years, pled guilty today to siphoning $750,000 of campaign funds for personal items and expenses. So he didn't really detail exactly what those expenses were, but he was in court today crying all over the place, apparently used up an entire box of tissues, and a court aide had to bring him another one. This comes on the heels of Rod Blagojevich, the last big Illinois politician to get in hot water over, some sketchy dealings. And Jesse Jackson Jr., I remember when I went down to D.C. to start work last year, early last summer, Jesse Jackson Jr. was giving a speech calling for a $10 minimum wage. Now we've got our $9 proposal being floated by the president. Jesse Jackson Jr. last year, riding high in Washington. He was certainly carrying the progressive torch to some extent, and looked like he had a brilliant career unfolding in front of him. Then he checked out of Congress because of some medical concerns, which turned out to be bipolar treatment. And since last June, he has not been there. And now this comes out, and it looks like it's the end of the road for him.
Now you got to wonder how much of that treatment was based on this. We're going to try to stall and delay this. Because look, at the end of the day, I don't care what side of the political aisle you're on. You're breaking the rules. You're siphoning, stealing, whatever word you want to use, that kind of cash. I got a serious problem with it. And, you know, I have very conservative friends who love to throw up cold cash Jefferson to me. Now I guess Jesse will be on the list as well.
Right. And luckily they do throw the books at these guys pretty typically. And we're hearing now 46 to 57 months in prison for this guy on top of a bunch of fines. So it looks like he'll be paying time for this.
Now, will he be paying time? I mean, he got $750,000. It's going to cost us $40,000 a year. It's going to cost us $40,000 a year to lock him up. I mean, you know, come on, $750,000. And I guess the other question is once the Supreme Court decides that, you know, you can use campaign money for whatever the hell you want and as much as you want from the billionaires, will this be a crime in another year or two or five?
Sure. I mean, yeah, it's a great question to ask. If corporations are giving money to a politician just because they like him in general, they may not have an expectation that any of that money is going to be used for campaign purposes. It's an interesting question. But as it stands now, this is a punishable offense. And, I think we're probably a little better off for having people like this and their behavior being targeted and being allowed to be punished.
I'm right there with you. But I look back at Christine O'Donnell and, you know, paying for living expenses and all of those things. I'm going, maybe I should just perpetually run for office and that'll just be my job.
Sure. Look, I'm guessing if this guy's been caught doing it on a huge level, that there are so many more people doing it on a small level. And I shudder to think exactly how deep this scandal goes. But at least this guy's been called out for it.
Well, at least when they build the new jail, it'll create a couple of new jobs. Luke Vargas, I appreciate the time.
Cheers. Have a good one.
Oh, it was great talking with you. Luke Vargas, Talk Radio News Service. Quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Earth, sky.
50,000 Quawer is a small, rocky world with its own moon, located in our solar system beyond the planet Neptune.
It's massive enough to be considered a dwarf planet, much as Pluto is now considered a dwarf planet. But the International Astronomical Union hasn't recognized Quawer as a dwarf planet just yet.
Astronomers discovered this object in 2002. It's extremely faint as seen from Earth. Its motion in front of the stars showed that it is closer to us than the stars, a member of our own solar system.
From the first, Quawer appeared relatively bright for such a distant object, but it was too small for even large telescopes to see in any detail. Astronomers were able to determine that it lies 1 billion kilometers beyond Pluto and moves around our sun every 288 years in a near-perfect circle.
NASA's Hubble Space Telescope was able to measure Quawer and found it to be 800 miles or 1,300 kilometers wide. That's about half Pluto's diameter. Its name, Quawer, is Native American from people in the area around Los Angeles, where the discovery of Quawer was made. The name represents an ancient creator god.
Later, astronomers reported a moon for Quawer. The moon is estimated to have only 1/2000th the mass of its parent world. For more, come to EarthSky.org and search for Planet Beyond Neptune. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
We're at EarthSky.org.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
Yes, as we screw up the post office and make sure that we run it out of business, as you know, it seems some want, there's some nostalgia, I guess, and, you know, the good capitalists are going to figure out how to profit off of that. An Ohio-based clothing company, they've decided that they're going to run a line of apparel under the name of Rain, Heat, and Snow. Pretty much the motto of the post office. You'll be able to buy, you know, what the postal workers wear. High fashion. You'll be able to buy ball caps and T-shirts and all kind of stuff. But they're going to start off with the winter wear to make sure that you stay warm. And you know where you'll be able to buy the line of clothing known as Rain, Heat, and Snow? Well, I don't know either, but I can tell you where you're not going to be able to buy it. The post office. And you go, exactly another reason why the post office is failing. I went to my local post office. I can't buy stamps other than going to the window. They used to have a machine. Took them out. I can deliver a package to FedEx from my post office. I can do that. Well, pretty well at that, actually. And, you know, you think about what we've done to the post office over the years. All of the new technology lobbied away. You know, and in talking with people who have been around for a number of years and who have done this, have been with the post office, you know, for 30, 40 years, you look at all of the new technology that was taken away from them. The overnight letter, that was FedEx's purview. Small packages taken away, legislated away, Congress. And now they say, well, you need to compete like the other ones. And, oh, by the way, we're going to saddle you with more. We're going to saddle you with more onerous regulations. I love that. I mean, stop and think about this for a second. The people who are talking about uncertainty, the people who are talking about job-killing regulation, are the very people who poison-pilled the post office. Which leads me back to my original premise that these people are full of it. It's all about profit. It's all about ideology. It's all about what they stick in their pocket. It has nothing to do with good. It has nothing to do with the free market. It has nothing to do with the commons. It's nothing to do with we the people. It has nothing to do with the Constitution. None of that. It's about me.
how much can I profit from my next job? But I think it'd be interesting, you know, to be able to go into the local post office while it's still around and buy myself a rain, heat, and snowwear outfit, you know, the all-weather stuff. You know, the footwear, the jackets, the coats, you know, stuff like that. The company who's doing it claims that they would like to launch a women's line. And originally my thought went to lingerie. Really? Postal lingerie? No. You know, Saturday deliveries. Since we're no longer going to be delivering mail on Saturday, you might as well get something out of it, right? Well, no. I'm not going to be doing that. So there you go. Maybe you can pick up your line of clothing as well. But, man, you know, it's frustrating to hear people who, and I go back to my conversation with Lee Fong about how the moneyed interests have really gotten onto a message and they have really sold it. This idea that the post office is antiquated, this idea, well, it's inefficient, is ridiculous on so many levels. You show me anywhere where for 45 cents I can send a letter, I can send something 3,000 miles away for 45 cents and do it in a couple of days. It's incredible. But here again, it's not profitable enough for them. And I had this interesting conversation with my uncle who did not believe me that the post office would have been profitable had it not been for this 75-year pension mandate that the Republicans heaped on them. And I said, you know, they're running like a company with handcuffs on. And look, I don't necessarily want them to make huge profits. I want them to provide a service at a reasonable price so that people can use it for the common good. So that we get products back and forth. We get our mail. We get our bills. All the magazine, whatever, everything. It's not a profit-generating motive for me. Maybe the clothes will bail them out. Evidently, a couple of bucks and the clothing sales will go towards bailing out the Postal Service. But I just don't see that as a big winner. What it shows to me is now you've got ideologues in charge of the post office. We're going to sell off the brand. We're going to sell off the marketing. And we'll let somebody make a buck off of its demise. Just shaking my head. Anyway, for folks who are Utah Jazz fans, I saw this, it just cracked me up. Evidently, for season ticket holders to the Utah Jazz who go to Energy Solutions Arena. Man, what are we doing to these? Evidently, they're as an appreciation, as a thank you for buying anywhere from $1,000 to $10,000 a year season tickets, they are going to give you a waffle iron. And then the waffle iron, it will have the Jazz logo. So every morning for the rest of your life, you can eat Jazz waffles. Wow. And only anywhere from $1,000 to $10,000 to do that. I guess it's better than the toaster that burns the team's logo into your bread. How about lower ticket prices? There's an idea. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, TheRickSmithShow.com, that's where you go to get the podcast. Don't forget Stitcher, if you want to take the program on the go on your smartphone. As always, you can email me, rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. Have a good one. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@TheRickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk. It's coming like the tide flood beneath us.